More Than Curious, A Science Memoir, by William H. Press, read by GPT-4 and the voice named Echo, copyright 2023, Part 1, Preface and Chapters 1 to 10. Preface: A combination of chance family origin, some amount of ability, and unusual luck put me in places and times to observe at close range some significant events and notable personalities in science, and to see and record some noteworthy interactions of science and scientists with politics and public affairs. Along the way, I got to know not just many in my own generation of scientists, but also an older generation whose famous discoveries went back in some cases to the 1930s. Later, I worked with, or for, not just scientists, but also technology capitalists and billionaires, nuclear weapons designers, admirals and generals, and political leaders, including two U.S. presidents. Reader, be assured, I was never close to winning any big prize for my own work, but my PhD advisor, Kip, and my PhD student, Adam, each did win Nobel Prizes for theirs, for discoveries that I had in a small way participated in. Over time, I came to think that parts of this story might be interesting to other scientists, or to present or future historians of science, or perhaps even to a general reader or two. The enforced isolation of the COVID pandemic in 2020 left me with the time and motivation to extract a narrative from my files and memory and turn it into something like a memoir. In fact, I did this twice. You are reading the shorter, more circumspect version, most directly the story of the making of a scientist, the body of his and others' scientific work, and some decades of his life in the public realm. I am pleased to make this version available to all who are interested. A longer, less polished, more personal version, written for my family, is for now unpublishable. It has more stories about sometimes difficult people, and it is freer with my unvarnished judgments about them, not just about their science. But too many of them are alive, and too many of these are still my friends, implying that these are stories not ready to be told. My life apart from science, and apart from my journey to becoming a scientist, is also described more fully in the longer, family version. A time-locked archive will someday make that version available to others, but not soon. In the meantime, I hope the stories in this volume will amuse or instruct. I decided to publish this memoir openly under a free Creative Commons license after discussions with several publishers. Regrettably, there seems today to be no significant commercial market for scientific memoirs of a kind that was once typified by the Sloan Foundation's series of scientific autobiographies. At the time, I found all of the Sloan volumes fascinating, even, or especially, the badly written ones. A badly written memoir is sometimes more revealing than a slick and polished one. A market does still exist for streamlined scientist memoirs with exciting, dramatic arcs. My path to a Nobel Prize, but that isn't my life, unfortunately. My anecdotes are picaresque, many, and I hope interesting or funny. Friends in the book business advised me that an academic or specialty press could easily be found to publish this work, but that would yield a tiny readership as compared to open publishing. Physicist Joe Polchinski came to a similar conclusion, posting his 2017 memoir on the ArXiv, albeit under tragic circumstances. Charlie Kennel entrusted his beautifully written 2023 memoir to the University of California's public e-scholarship repository, and there are other examples of this trend. I like CERN's Zenodo repository for its promise of maintaining availability for 20 years or the lifetime of the European Union, whichever is longer. No commercial publisher offers that deal for keeping a book in print. Memoir is, by definition, as remembered. From my pre-publication circulation of this work, I have already learned that others remember some events herein quite differently from me. I have corrected, and will try to correct in future updates, things objectively untrue that I wrongly state as fact, as opposed to memory, interpretation, or what I thought or knew at the time. For disputes in these latter categories, I enthusiastically invite participants to record their own versions in blogs, articles, podcasts, books, or social media, and to archive such recollections in one of the several permanent online scientific repositories. Then future historians, if they actually care, can try to sort things out. Chapter 1. DNA. In July 2010, I was part of a group of scientists advising the federal government on what was soon to be called personal genetics, the ability for individual consumers to have their genomes easily sequenced. One of the presentations made to our group was by Anne Wojcicki, the founder of a startup company called 23andMe. Anne was married to Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, so she was one of the richest people in the world. I have barely any recollection of Anne's talk, but after the talk, she handed out little cards, individually signed by her, which entitled the recipient to have their genome sequenced for free. At the time, I was a member of President Obama's Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and subject to various draconian rules regarding bribery and the accepting of gifts, so I didn't take a card. It is possible that, had I taken one and kept it, it might be more valuable today as an autograph with a unique provenance. Sometime later, however, I did order, at retail price, the 23andMe kit. A couple of weeks after spitting into the little plastic vial, I got my results. Today, DNA Ancestry is a well-developed business, and competing companies have big, proprietary databases. In 2010, there existed very little such data. 23andMe could put my saliva through their machine and read my genome, but they didn't, then, have much ground truth on verified ancestry. The best they could do with their limited database was to find the 50 customers whose genomes were closest to mine and then send me the list of those people's self-reported ancestries. I was on my own to draw any conclusions. My list, when I received it, went like this: 1 Ashkenazi, 2 Ashkenazi, 3 Ashkenazi, and so forth, all the way down to 48 Ashkenazi, 49 Ashkenazi, and then the ringer: 50, Eastern European, perhaps Jewish. I have some news for you, person number 50. Not only are you Jewish, you are doubtless Ashkenazi. If genetics were truly destiny, my memoir could end here, since I am genetically nearly identical to an inbred population of a few million Ashkenazi Jews concentrated in the United States, Israel, Russia, South Africa, Australia, and before the Holocaust, Germany and Poland. If genetics were determinative, we Ashkenazim would all have similar lives, like the triplets separated at birth who, if you believe the internet, all became firemen. That is nonsense, of course. Much more important than genetics is environment, a catch-all word that encompasses our physical and biological surround, the foods we eat, the air we breathe, the microbial ecology of our guts, the influences of our family, our pets, the people we meet, our culture, profession or work, nation, and historical milieu. Those 3 billion A, C, G, and T nucleotides in our genome might seem to contain a lot of information, but their content is minuscule compared to the quantity individually delivered to my inbred Ashkenazi ancestors and me by lifetimes of environmental happenstance. That reality luckily leaves me with different stories to tell. And I didn't become a fireman. Between roughly 1880 and 1924, after which a wave of restrictive immigration laws was passed, something like 2 million Jews immigrated to the United States from Eastern Europe. My maternal ancestors arrived toward the beginning of this wave, my paternal ancestors near the end. On the maternal side, I am named for my mother's father, known to me as William Henry Kallick. We grandchildren called him Poppy. Poppy's name was just one of the big and small lies that he told about himself. This was a small one. His name seems actually to have been William Harry Kallick. Henry, substituted for Harry, seemed less Jewish. Poppy was born the day after Christmas, December 26, 1890, at 124 Kenilworth Street, Philadelphia. His parents, Louis and Eva Kallick, emigrated from Odessa, Russia, now Ukraine, to Philadelphia a few years before. If not exactly a lie, the name Kallick was not the original name, which may have been Kaliski, a Polish surname and geographical district. According to Poppy, his father was employed as a taster in Seagram's distillery in Philadelphia. He started swallowing and became an alcoholic. He died saving people from a burning building when Poppy was a child. Since this report came from Poppy, it is probably not true. In truth, even the year of William Kallick's birth is not entirely certain. His mother would have been 50 when he was born. Very unlikely. In 1936, he went before a judge and swore under penalty of perjury that his birth records had been lost in a fire, and that he was born on December 26, 1894, 4 years later than we now think. That would have made his mother, Eva, 54 when she gave birth, virtually impossible in those times. My maternal grandmother, Mary Kallick, later propagated the story that Poppy lowered his age the better to attract younger women with whom he had affairs. Poppy was 5'6", not considered short in his generation, and weighed 150 pounds. A photograph of him on the beach at Coney Island in the early 1940s shows a virile man in a skimpy swimsuit who looks to be younger than 50 years. He seems proud to be posing for the picture. His is the well-muscled appearance of the man who gets the girl in the old back of comic book advertisements, the one who takes her away from the 97-pound weaklings. Those would be the men on my father's side of the family. In 1955, Poppy tried to change his birth date back by 6 years, to December 26, 1888, so as to qualify for Social Security payments. The attempt failed. When I was growing up, Poppy was a proofreader at the New York Times and a proud member of the International Typographical Union, Local Number 6. Proofreading was the highest and most intellectual of the craft, as opposed to editorial positions in the printing trade. Poppy had worked his way up at several newspapers in Philadelphia, St. Louis, and New York as a young man setting type by hand and later as a linotype operator. He graduated from the trade school equivalent of high school in Philadelphia and loved everything about the printed word, albeit grammar and punctuation more than content. In no way was he an intellectual. His daily reading centered on the tabloid New York Daily News, not the highbrow New York Times, and the Police Gazette, a racy tabloid men's magazine. Poppy set my mother on the path to college and to a professional career as a school teacher. She adored him. As an adolescent, an adult, it was her father's version of the truth that she believed when, as happened more and more often, her mother would insinuate other interpretations for his behavior. "Your father has the moral fiber of a pissant," was one of Mary's favorite aphorisms. After one unexplained absence of several days, William returned home bearing a gift for Mary, several items of expensive lingerie, clean but used and monogrammed with another woman's initials. He said that they were a bargain because they fell off the back of a truck. Mary Kallick, my grandmother, whom we called Nana, was 3 years older than William. She was born Hinda Amdur, probably in what is now Poland. Her name changed to Helen Ender when, as a one-year-old baby, she emigrated with her parents, Meyer and Esther, to Philadelphia. In elementary school, she became Mary Helen Enders. Names of immigrants could be fluid in this way. William and Mary were married in Yonkers, New York, on December 30, 1918. Their first child, a son, died in 1919 shortly after his birth. Their second child, Louis, was born in 1920. By 1925, when my mother was born, the family had moved to St. Louis. My mother was named Billy after her father. Feminine versions of boys' names were in fashion for baby girls in St. Louis at the time. Louis died of scarlet fever in 1928 at the age of 8. My mother was 3 at the time. "Why did it have to be the boy?" Mary is supposed to have said. Mary, who died in 1958, never seemed to recover from the loss of her 2 sons. She told my mother that their deaths were God's punishment, but never explained for what. My mother's younger sister Evelyn was born as the result of an accidental pregnancy in 1931. The family had moved to Brooklyn, New York, to an apartment at 705 Prospect Place, later a somewhat better apartment at 1011 Ocean Avenue. I knew Mary, Nana, as a dour woman, the grandparent who always said no. William, Poppy, was the grandparent who could be counted on for yes. After Nana died, Poppy, nearing 70 and retired from the Times with a small union pension, lived alone for a time in his rent-controlled apartment on Ocean Avenue. In a stroke of good luck, he somehow connected with a distant Philadelphia cousin, a widow, Fanny. She soon moved to Brooklyn, and they began living together. Conveniently, as cousins, they shared the last name Kallick. In those times, it was disreputable for an unmarried couple to be living together, even when both were septuagenarians. In April 1967, when I was a sophomore at Harvard, Poppy took me to Philadelphia to show me the old neighborhood where he grew up. We walked on Front Street between Kenilworth Street and the Delaware River. Poppy said he had worked as a stevedore on the docks. A couple of years after my visit, this neighborhood and the river were sliced apart by the construction of the Delaware Expressway, Interstate 95. He located the street corners where his gang had fought and drank beer, and where he and his chums sang close harmony barbershop quartet songs for nickels from passersby at the corner of Bainbridge and 2nd, outside of Callahan's store. As improbable as the latter sounds, now and then, I can attest to the fact that Poppy knew by heart the lyrics and tenor and baritone parts for dozens of popular songs from the period roughly 1890 to 1910, and that he carried in his wallet an expired membership card for SPEBSQSA, the Society for Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America, an organization well known to aficionados. In the 1970s, Fanny's health deteriorated, and she moved back to Philadelphia to be with her two daughters. Poppy gave up his Brooklyn apartment and moved to Belmont, Massachusetts to live with my parents. He died in 1978 after a debilitating series of strokes. Soon afterwards, Fanny's younger daughter Sylvia, then in her mid-60s, wrote to my mother, "Dear Billy, at last we are able to tell you the truth about our father, William Kallick." Fanny, the distant cousin who had moved in with my grandfather after my grandmother died, was no cousin at all. She was my grandfather's first, in fact, only legal wife. The true story seems to be this. Mary Enders and Fanny Weiss were best friends who worked in a textile factory, sewing. Neither had schooling beyond 6th grade. Around 1910, when both were in their early 20s, they became friendly with a handsome young printer, William Harry Kallick. Before long, Fanny was pregnant. A marriage occurred in 1911, and baby Ada Kallick was born soon after that. A second daughter, Sylvia, followed 2 years later. One way or another, Mary Enders was still in the picture. Her turn to get pregnant by William came in 1918. Notwithstanding that William was married to Fanny, he and Mary ran off together and were married in Yonkers in December 1918. Their baby was born some months later and died soon after. Little wonder that, with the death of both sons, Mary might feel that God was punishing her. There is no record of any divorce of William and Fanny. My grandfather was a bigamist. There is no record in the 1900 or 1910 U.S. Census of a family named Kallick, or anything similar, living at 124 Kenilworth Street, the address that Poppy always gave as his birthplace, and to which he led me when we visited Philadelphia together. It may be that he was not born in the United States at all. In an archived U.S. citizenship application dated December 3, 1908, one Harry William Kallick, a printer, age 19, swears that he was born in Odessa, Russia, sick, on October 2, 1889, and that he emigrated to the United States in July 1892. This could even be the truth, or a version of the truth. Or maybe it was identity theft, someone conveniently using my grandfather's identity, with or without his knowledge. Or maybe he stole someone else's identity. We will never know what parts of Poppy's life story are fabrications. The undeniable fact that I am my grandfather's grandson is one that the reader might want to keep in mind. Chapter 2. New Americans. In 1915, Russian army positions collapsed in the face of a massive offensive by the German Kaiser, and the armies of Tsar Nicholas retreated in disorder far back into Russia's defensive depth. In Minsk, still barely under Russian control, my paternal grandparents, Sholom Press, who was 22, and his fiancée, Dvera Steingoltz, 21, decided to secretly emigrate to America. They were both escaping and eloping. Dvera's parents disapproved of the religiously non-observant Sholom, and he was in danger of being drafted into the Tsar's army. Sholom and Dvera, in America they became Solomon, or Sol, and Dora, were urban Jews of, in his case, a low commercial stratum. He had completed high school, a rarity for Jews then, and worked in a bank. Dora was a milliner. The two obtained forged papers and traveled on the Trans-Siberian Railway to the large Russian expatriate colony in Harbin, China. Dora found temporary work making hats, while Solomon sought passage to the United States. The plan was for Saul, once in New York, to locate his older brother Barnett and then send for Dora. She accompanied him from Harbin as far as Yokohama, where they were officially married on December 25th. Saul sailed from Yokohama on January 23, 1916, on the steamship Manila Maru. As unlikely as it seems, events unfolded exactly according to their plan. Dora, by then well along in pregnancy, sailed on the Yokohama Maru on June 19th, arriving in Seattle on July 7th, from where she traveled by train to New York. Their son Samuel, my Uncle Sam, was born in Brooklyn on October 20th. The accepted dates of Dora's pregnancy are just barely biologically possible. But 90 years later, after the revelations about William Kallik on my mother's side of the family, how could we of the younger generation not wonder whether everything about our grandmother's first pregnancy was, well, kosher? We convinced my cousin Fred, Uncle Sam's only child, to have his DNA sequenced. The results were unequivocally ordinary. Cousin Fred's grandfather was definitely Solomon Press. Sam may have been conceived the very night before Sol's ship sailed. When I knew him as Grandpa, his business card said, "Sol Press, cash buyer." He sometimes took me with him on his business rounds. It went like this. We systematically walked the streets of a chosen, generally run-down neighborhood in Brooklyn. Grandpa somehow selected a small store, and we went inside. He was a small, nondescript man who attracted little attention while scouting the place. A fraction of the time, he approached the counter and asked politely, in his thick Russian/Yiddish accent, if the person behind the counter was the owner. If the answer was yes, Saul presented his business card and took out of his pocket a large roll of $100 bills. His was an immediate offer to buy the entire establishment, including the unexpired lease, the fixtures, and the stock of merchandise, all for cash then and there. Mostly his offers were refused, sometimes angrily, but occasionally the owner welcomed my grandfather as an angel sent from heaven. These were shop owners who knew that their business was failing, but could see no path to a new start. Grandpa's business depended on his sizing up in a couple of minutes the cash value of the store, and also the actual amount that a distressed owner might be willing to take. The few times I witnessed this, in the early 1960s, the amounts were in the few thousand dollars. The back end of Grandpa's business was to hire an auctioneer, schedule an auction for the fixtures, find other similar stores to whom he could sell the merchandise at a suitable discount from wholesale, list the property as a sublet, and so forth. The part I liked was when, in the store, he closed a deal. He would say to me, "Go look around, Billy. Take anything you want." Because now he owned it all. According to my father, there were times during the Great Depression when the family was forced to operate a store for weeks or months before he could get an acceptable price for selling it. My father remembers soda jerking as a kid in a candy store that Saul bought mainly for the fixtures. There was a ladies' lingerie store that proved hard to unload. In better times, Saul would put together somewhat larger deals, collecting money from other investors. Whether one should view his business as capitalism at its purest or as pure economic bottom feeding is a matter of perspective, even assuming that the two alternatives are actually different. Saul and Dora had three sons, Sam, already mentioned, Paul, who followed less than 2 years later, and my father, Frank, who was born in 1924, 6 and 8 years younger than his two brothers. Theirs was very much an old-world family, with children obedient to their parents. The language of the parents in the home was Yiddish. The newspaper they subscribed to was the Daily Forward, printed in Yiddish. Dora read every page. The children understood Yiddish fluently, but were not allowed to speak it. They were allowed to speak only English so that they would be Americans. Unlike for my maternal grandparents, it would never have occurred to my paternal grandparents to try to pass as non-Jews. They lived their whole lives as Russian Jewish immigrants in Jewish neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Their determination that their three sons be 100% American was fierce, however. There was no religious observance in the family, except for one anomaly. All three boys went to Hebrew school, summer camp in Frank's case, for just long enough to qualify to be bar mitzvahed at age 13. The closest my father came to adolescent rebellion was that he became religiously observant, to the family's disapproval, for some months before his bar mitzvah, but it soon wore off. Sol's politics, to the extent that they were visible, were somewhere on the socialist left, generally aligned with the Daily Forward as pro-union, democratic socialist, and anti-Bolshevik. The radio at home was always tuned to WEV, for Eugene Victor Debs, which broadcast a Yiddish hour on Sunday mornings. Years later, when my father was nominated by President Kennedy for a White House advisory committee, the FBI found a photograph of Saul's car in their undercover files. a green Chevy in a communist-sponsored parade in New York in the 1940s. My father insisted that his father must have loaned the car to a friend. Family obligation went both ways. Years later, when Frank was a young professor at Caltech, he got a phone call from Sam. "I've decided to run for Congress, Frank, and I need $5,000 for my campaign." This was not a small amount, probably 3 months of Frank's Caltech salary at the time. There was nothing about Sam's solo law practice that evidenced any kind of political connection. My father sent him a check. We never heard another word about his campaign, nor did he ever pay back any of the money. What is likely is that he simply needed the money, and this was a face-saving way to ask his brother for it, a request that, in that family, could not be refused. Many years later, it occurred to me that the running for Congress story was known to us only via Frank. It is possible that he invented it for my mother, who did not share Frank's absolute sense of family obligation. Billy first noticed Frank in their high school honors history class when she was a junior, he a senior. She had blossomed in high school. She got straight A's. She had the figure of a Betty Grable pinup girl. Her hair was naturally blonde, or at least a very, very light brown. Thanks to her father, her grammar and diction were excellent, and she often spoke up in class. Frank was the smartest boy in class, she thought. He rarely spoke up, but when he did, his thinking struck her as intellectual and insightful. Frank graduated from high school in June 1941 and started college at the Free City College of New York that September. With Pearl Harbor came the draft, but Frank was initially too young to serve. His older brothers both served in the Army, and, as it turned out when he did register, also too nearsighted. He was classified as not acceptable for military service. At CCNY, he majored in physics. In his first year, he joined the physics club and by a mailed letter invited my mother and her friend Elaine to the physics club dance, if one can imagine such a thing. Billy herself was dating boys who had been drafted and were about to go to war. They dated throughout their college years. Billy won a full support scholarship to NYU, a private university that was considered intellectually and socially a cut above CCNY. Dora, Frank's mother, disapproved of Billy, not just because future mothers-in-law always disapprove of their future daughters-in-law, but specifically because she didn't believe that Billy was actually Jewish. Blonde hair, NYU, family with a non-Jewish name, Dora was certain that Billy was a shiksa, some kind of Delilah, intent on robbing Frank of his strength. Dora's facts were wrong, but her intuition was not completely faulty. A part of Frank's attraction to Billy was that she was so shiksa-like, yet, theoretically, Jewish. He could have his assimilative cake and eat it too. Frank was programmed from birth to break out of the ghetto, and Billy, he thought, would help him succeed. Chapter 3. Lamont. Everything was accelerated because of the war. City College was pumping undergraduates through its normal four-year curriculum in 3 years or less, with Frank as a willing beneficiary. He finished his undergraduate studies late in 1944 and was quickly accepted for graduate school in physics at Columbia. The thought of leaving New York City never crossed his or Billy's minds. Promising graduate students in the sciences could earn their keep as teaching assistants in undergraduate courses, meaning that Frank's brothers would not need to continue to support him, an important consideration. After physics graduate students finished their coursework, 1 year, or two at most, they could be promoted to research assistant. But, for this, they had to be accepted for PhD thesis work by a specific professor. When Billy and Frank were married in June, 1946, Frank had finished his master's degree and was looking for a PhD advisor. Billy found work as a nursery school teacher. In 1947, Columbia University recruited as a professor the prominent oceanographer and geophysicist Maurice Doc Ewing. Ewing, a larger-than-life Texan, grew up in the tiny town of Lochney. His ascent to the pantheon of great 20th-century geoscientists was made possible, indirectly, by the sensational murder in 1900 of William Marsh Rice, the Texas real estate, lumber, cotton, and railroad magnate whose fortune endowed the new tuition-free William Marsh Rice Institute, later known as Rice University. Ewing was in Rice's 10th undergraduate class. He received his bachelor's degree in 1926 and worked as an instructor while pursuing his PhD, awarded in 1931. After that, he moved to Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and worked up the academic ladder. In support of the war effort, Doc, as he was now called, moved to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, a hub of wartime oceanographic support to the U.S. Navy. Woods Hole was where Doc became known not just to senior oceanographers, but also to Navy admirals and the several New York financiers who were themselves involved in the war effort. Some combination of things in Doc, not least his expansive Texas manner and rough country charm, made him successful at making things happen. Prior to Doc's arrival at Columbia, Frank showed no particular interest in oceanography, geology, or the newer field of what was called geophysics. As a physics student, he was mathematically advanced and almost entirely theoretical. Columbia was the nexus of a golden age in experimental physics after the war, but Frank doesn't appear to have ever set foot in an experimental laboratory. He was a city boy to the core, thin, pale, scholarly, with thick glasses. The closest he ever came to an ocean was the beach at Coney Island, and he was never a strong swimmer. Still, for some reason, opportunity or ambition, Frank beat a path to Doc Ewing's door and was accepted as Doc's first graduate student. Whether as a probationary test or as an initiation rite, Doc immediately sent Frank to sea for a 6-week oceanographic expedition on the Woods Hole research vessel, RV Atlantis. The Atlantis was a 460-ton sailing vessel, rigged as a Bermuda ketch with triangular sails on her two masts, a jib and spinnaker in front. It had a crew of 17, leaving room for just 5 scientists. Its cruising range was effectively unlimited, as long as the wind blew. On Frank's maiden voyage, the refrigeration unit broke down, and they ate rotting meat for 2 weeks with A1 steak sauce to disguise the taste. After that, Frank couldn't stand the taste of A1 steak sauce, but he was a full-blooded oceanographer. I was born 9 months after Frank got back from that cruise. The pregnancy was unplanned. Billy went into labor at a performance of Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado in Manhattan on a Friday night. My parents took a taxi to the hospital. I was born on Sunday morning, May 23, 1948, after a grueling 40-hour labor. By the calendar, I was slightly premature, but I weighed 9.5 pounds. Once at Columbia, Doc Ewing put his unusual powers of persuasion to work in some important ways. He befriended Wall Street banker Thomas W. Lamont, and after Lamont's death in February 1948, Lamont's widow, Florence. Lamont was a partner at J.P. Morgan & Co., rising to chairman of the board, who had undertaken diplomatic missions for Presidents Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Hoover, and Franklin Roosevelt. Tom and Florence's weekend retreat was a 135-acre estate in Palisades, New York, a hamlet in Rockland County across the Hudson River from the city. Doc persuaded Florence to donate the entire estate, which the Lamonts called Torrey Cliff, to Columbia University as its new Lamont Geological Observatory, stipulating that he, Doc, would be its first director and control all of the donated resources. The gift was made while Frank was still Doc's graduate student. Lamont Geological Observatory opened its doors in 1949. Frank received his PhD just after that. His PhD diploma was signed by Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was briefly president of Columbia between his careers as World War II Allied commander and president of the United States. Eisenhower was also instrumental in obtaining $200,000 from mining and oil companies as initial funds for Ewing to get the new laboratory going. In a political deal, 10 acres of the original estate, the piece on the New Jersey side of the New York border, was deeded to Robert Moses' New Palisades Interstate Parkway Highway. Doc's lesser but still significant piece of persuasion was to convince Columbia to acquire a steel-hulled, 3-masted schooner, originally E.F. Hutton's luxury yacht Hussar, but now rusting as scrap off of Staten Island. Restored as an oceanographic research vessel and rechristened the RV Vima, this 585-ton ship was the jewel in the crown of Ewing's oceanographic enterprise. It made Lamont, the proper noun soon meaning Ewing's Institute, not its donor, a peer and competitor to Woods Hole. Frank made several cruises on the Vima. Doc decreed that he and his subordinates would move from the city and live on the Lamont estate. Besides Frank, the original small group consisted of new PhDs, Joe, J. Lamar Wurzel, and Jack Nafee, and also Angelo Ludus, an expert machinist and first-generation Greek-Italian immigrant, as Lamont's shop foreman. During the war, Ludus had worked at Columbia on the Manhattan Project developing the atomic bomb. Wurzel was an expert on geomagnetism, whom Doc had taught at Lehigh and taken with him to Woods Hole and then Columbia. He and Frank were never personally close. Nafe had been in the Merchant Marine and taught physics at the U.S. Naval Academy during the war, this before getting a PhD. At Columbia, he was a student in I. Robbie's experimental physics lab. Robbie was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1944. His lab was world famous. Still, Ewing was able to charm Nafe and poach him for the new Lamont. Jack Oliver, a later addition, attended Columbia on a football scholarship, did war service as a Navy Seabee, and soon moved to Lamont as its first resident graduate student. The tens of rooms in the Lamont Mansion, which was known as the Big House, were converted to office and laboratory spaces. Doc, his wife Midge, and his three children lived in the estate guest house while Columbia built for them an imposing new residence. A few hundred yards from the Big House, around a bend in the estate road with shielding woods, there were three small white clapboard houses where Lamont's servants had lived. Wurzel and his wife Dottie and their three children were given the largest of these, Naffy, the second largest, Frank and Billy and me, the smallest. The downstairs in our house consisted of a living room and a kitchen. Up a steep and narrow flight of stairs were the bathroom and three tiny bedrooms under attic dormers. There was a cellar with a coal bin and a coal-fired furnace. When the weather was cold, Frank stoked the furnace with coal in the morning and banked the coals at night. I lived here from age about 1 to age 7. What I remember about our family's life in Palisades is an idyllic existence, me running practically wild on the large, beautiful estate. I don't recall ever needing to ask my mother whether I could go outside and play, alone or with the other children. I just did it. The back door, off the kitchen porch, opened onto a field of tall grass with an old hay wagon in it. At some point, my father painted the wagon bright red for us kids. My sister, Paula, was born when I was 2 1/2. There was a rope swing hanging from the limb of a tree. A fenced field of cows was immediately across the dirt road that led to the Luda's house. Our front door led to the gravel road that connected with the Wurzel's house. Howie Wurzel was a couple of years older than me, Richie Wurzel a couple of years younger, so there was no perfect match of playmates. But the Wurzel's living room boasted the only accessible television on the estate, so it became the central gathering point. The Ewings had a television, but we were never allowed to play in their grander house. Dottie Wurzel was, in effect, the neighborhood mom. It was she who ran back and fetched the fire extinguisher when Richie and I, playing with matches, set fire to the pine needles in the woods behind their house. Dottie's brother was Albert P. Crary, one of the last heroic polar explorers. The Wurzel-Crary connection was that Crary had taken a master's degree at Lehigh while Joe was there with Doc Ewing. When Uncle Bert visited, the kids, including me, were willing to turn off the television and listen to his Arctic stories. He spent several summers as chief scientist on Ice Island T3, a several-mile-long piece of ice floating in the Arctic Ocean that was inhabited as a U.S. Navy weather station between 1952 and 1954. I still have several letters from him addressed to me, Billy Press, with Ice Island T3, U.S. Navy postmarks. A few years later, Crary, on his 1960-61 expedition in Antarctica, became the first person to have set foot on both the North and South Poles. Farther afield than the Wurzel house on the Lamont estate, there was a big garden plot of strawberries and rhubarb. Behind that was the tea garden, with lilacs and sweet peas and a formal fountain. We kids avoided going there. We thought it was haunted. Behind that, a field of corn. Since in the summer the corn was taller than we were, we made mazes in the cornfield by trampling narrow paths with branching intersections. Surrounding Lamont, the hamlet of Palisades, was not a welcoming community. There were old money estates with panoramic river views at the top of the Palisades. Below the cliffs, in an area called Sneeden's Landing, a kind of wealthy artist's colony had established itself in the 1930s. New Yorker writer E.B. White, he of Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web, described the place as steeped in Hudson Valley mists and memories. People make their own wine, stamp out their own copperhead snakes, go picking Dutchman's breeches in the spring. On summer evenings, you can hear the trains across the river, grumbling. There is a good deal of talk about shad, as may be. The urbane residents of his time included Aaron Copland, John Dos Passos, and Noel Coward. By the early 1950s, when Ewing's boy scientists invaded and took over the Lamont estate, Sneeden's Landing's center of gravity had shifted from literature toward show folk, successful Broadway producers and actors. Palisade's old wealth and new wealth coexisted in a kind of arm's-length mutual admiration. The super-rich were secretly starstruck, and the stars were secretly jealous of old money. One thing that they agreed on was that the influx of city academics and their families from across the river was a bad thing. Midge Ewing was a kidder, so she was different and immediately sought after by the Sneeden's Landing people. Billy was even more isolated socially than the other wives. She was brash, talkative, inner city, hyper-correct in schoolteacher diction, and, up to now, self-confident. No one in Palisades would care that she had been valedictorian of Tilden High School or been one of very few Jewish girls allowed into NYU, and with a full scholarship no less. She probably didn't know what Dutchman's breeches were, and I'm certain that she never talked about shad. Billy had heard of copperheads. I remember her showing me pictures of the snake in books, warning me not to accidentally step on one in the woods next to our house. That is my closest personal connection to E.B. White. Frank, not unlike many career-driven fathers in the 1950s, was for me a largely absent parent. Child-raising was Billy's job. I recall only once Frank's taking me to his lab in the big house. I remember his handing me an ohmmeter, a device that measures electrical resistance, and telling me to go around the laboratory and figure out which things were conductors of electricity, which insulators, and to record the results on a pad of paper. He probably wanted me to amuse myself so that he could get work done. I made and recorded, in first grader block letters, many careful measurements. Chapter 4. To California. Doc Ewing's boys and the growing scientific staff at Lamont were making discoveries that would prove to be among the greatest in 20th century geoscience. Lamont's scientists perfected the techniques of underwater seismology. The basic idea was to toss lit sticks of dynamite off the back of a ship like research vessel Vima. These would explode underwater and produce acoustic shock waves that traveled through the water into the deep ocean sediments far below. Geological discontinuities, layers or structures in the sub-ocean rock, generated reflected sound waves that could be measured and interpreted back on the ship. The technique was not unlike using dynamite in boreholes to search for oil, something Doc was familiar with from his Texas oil days, and also a reason for his sending Frank off to get consulting experience with oil company Flying A when I was 2. The family spent the summer in Texas, my earliest retained memories. Wurzel and Ewing are credited with the fundamental discovery that the ocean bottoms have always been ocean bottoms. They are not sunken continents, as many had believed, and A2's hinted at in the name of the Woods Hole oceanographic research vessel, the Atlantis. Frank, with some assistance from Wenceslas Jardetsky, a high-born Russian emigre who washed ashore at Columbia in 1946, developed a body of highly mathematical work on how sound should be expected to propagate, refract, and reflect in various configurations of sub-ocean geology. A few years later, this work was published as a book, Elastic Waves in Layered Media, by Ewing, Jardetsky, and Press. Ewing contributed nothing to the book. He understood its mathematics in only the most general way, but he insisted on being a first author on the grounds that his laboratory, indeed his ship, the Vima, was responsible for all the data that the book sought to explain. Jardetsky, although he was basically a hired hand, was 10 years older than Ewing, so Ewing awarded him seniority as second author, above Frank. It was unjust. Science is full of stories like this, many worse. Frank somehow managed to get his name before Doc's on the Press Ewing seismograph, an instrument that he developed with help from Angelo Ludus, whose name appears nowhere. Astronomer Jeremiah Ostricker once explained to me his theory about three-author works. One author does all the work, another takes all the credit, the third is the fall guy, brought on to take the blame if the work turns out to be wrong. Since Ewing took the credit and Press did the work, Jardetsky may have been the fall guy. The Lamont scientists contributed to, but were appallingly slow to embrace the greatest discovery of 20th century geology, that of plate tectonics. In 1912, Alfred Wegener, a German meteorologist and polar researcher, proposed that the Earth's continents, composed primarily of granite, were floating, iceberg-like, on a global lithosphere of denser basalt rock. Even more outlandish, Wegener posited that the continents were slowly moving, drifting around the globe, at times breaking apart, at times colliding. Wegener named his hypothetical original single continent Pangaea. This theory of continental drift might explain diverse mysteries, such as how seemingly tropical fossils come to be found in what are now Arctic regions, or why the east coast of South America looks like it fits so perfectly into the west coast of Africa. Wegener's ideas were rejected outright by most established geologists and oceanographers, including Ewing and those under his influence. The seabed revealed by Ewing's underwater seismology was made of layer upon layer of undisturbed sediment, miles deep. There was no evidence that continents had ever plowed through it on their way from one place to another. In this vein, Dock and Frank wrote a paper with the title On the Permanence of the Ocean Basins. It proved to be completely wrong. Ironically, Ewing's team was already responsible for some of the first hard evidence that the continents were drifting, but they failed to interpret that evidence correctly. Ewing's 1947 expedition on the Atlantis first discovered what we now call the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, an underwater feature of mountain ranges and canyons that runs continuously down the middle of the North and South Atlantic Oceans. Subsequent traverses by the VIMA allowed the ridge to be mapped in detail by Lamont scientists Bruce Heason and Marie Tharp. We now understand mid-ocean ridges, a network of them encircle the Earth, as the seams where magma is being forced upward, then spreading outward in both directions away from the ridges to form new seabed. The continents don't plow through the seabed, they float on plates of mostly oceanic lithosphere, and they move with those plates. When continents collide, mountain ranges are formed, for example, the Himalayas. More generally, when plates collide, one plate is forced underneath the other, subducted down into the Earth's mantle, where it melts into the general convective flow, its material reborn in a distant mid-ocean ridge some hundreds of millions of years later. These are ideas that could have been developed and verified by the Lamont scientists, but they weren't. I have a clear memory from Palisades of my father using a globe to explain to me the basic idea of continental drift, then explaining why it was surely wrong. I wish I could reproduce that part. Doc Ewing's priceless, unintentional gift to the competing groups at Cambridge University, Teddy Bullard and Fred Vine, and Princeton, Harry Hess, was to publish a wealth of oceanographic, seismic, and geomagnetic data, and then to let others make the intellectual leaps that he was too stubborn to make himself, and too autocratic to let those who worked for him make. Frank did eventually embrace plate tectonics. There was no other way. In the 1980s, he bought a 28-foot sailboat and named it Pangaea. Below the Earth's crustal plates lies the Earth's rocky mantle, which extends down about halfway to the center of the Earth. Below the mantle lies a molten, metallic, mostly iron, core. The exact location of the liquid core was deduced from earthquake recordings, seismograms, in 1913 by the German seismologist Benno Gutenberg. The connection to Frank's career and my upbringing in Southern California is direct. Benno Gutenberg was born to a well-off Jewish family in Darmstadt in 1889. He attended Göttingen, the preeminent German university, and received his PhD in 1911. He discovered the Earth's liquid core just 2 years later. As World War I erupted, Gutenberg entered the German army and was assigned to the infantry. Injured by a grenade, he was reassigned to the Meteorological Corps, where he assisted in wind forecasts that were essential for the use of poison gas by the Germans. The Kaiser awarded him a medal. Despite his fame as a scientist and his war record, he was unable to secure a permanent university position. The 1920s were difficult times in Germany, and rising anti-Semitism was a factor. Gutenberg supported himself by helping to manage his father's cosmetics factory, working with seismological data in his off hours. The narrative next shifts halfway around the world. In 1921, the Carnegie Institution of Washington, one of more than 20 charitable organizations established by Andrew Carnegie, not to mention 2,509 public libraries, established a seismological station in Pasadena, California. Although it was legally a separate entity, the Seismological Laboratory, or SeismoLab, was soon closely associated with the geology department of neighboring California Institute of Technology. In 1930, Robert Millikan, Caltech's Nobel laureate president, and Harry Wood, the SeismoLab's director, recruited Benno Gutenberg from Germany to California. The idea was that Caltech would take over the SeismoLab and that Gutenberg would become its director, joining its two senior scientists, Charles Richter and Hugo Benioff. The transfer took place in 1937. By that time, Richter was famous for his development with Gutenberg of the Richter scale for earthquake magnitudes, to this day the most widely used measure. Unlike Doc Ewing, Benno Gutenberg did not insist on putting his name on everything, and historians of science credit Gutenberg with most of the ideas that went into the Richter scale. Benioff, though less a household name, was famous in the field as the inventor of the Benioff seismograph, a design still in use around the world. Contributing to the discovery of plate tectonics, Benioff would later discover the pattern of deep earthquakes that demarcate the subduction of one plate under another. In 1955, Gutenberg was, at 66, close to retirement age. Benioff was 60. Richter was 55. I was 7. Benioff expected to be named to succeed Gutenberg as director. Richter didn't want to be director himself. He didn't think of himself as a good administrator, but he was not happy with the idea of the position going to Benioff. Nothing was out in the open, but behind the scenes, it was a standoff. Gutenberg and Bob Sharp, the geology department chair, hatched the idea of recruiting Frank Press, not immediately to be the new director, but with that succession in mind for the future. Frank was Doc's boy genius rising star. He was an outstanding theorist, and he also was good at building things in the laboratory, seismometers, amplifiers, sensors. In his parents' apartment in Brooklyn, Frank had built radios as a teenager. He published prodigiously. Sharp and Gutenberg made him an offer to come to Caltech and the SeismoLab as a full professor. Frank says that the discussion of the directorship never came up. I find that hard to believe. He was 31. I have vivid memories as I was growing up of all of these individuals from social occasions in Pasadena at their houses or at ours. The Gutenbergs, Benno and Hertha, treated Frank like a son, Paula and me like grandchildren. They had almost impenetrable German accents. Benno was a diminutive man, totally bald and practically deaf. He wore a vacuum tube amplifier hearing aid, about the size of a modern cell phone, except 2 inches thick and in a silver case. Hertha had been a good friend of Albert Einstein. The Benioffs, Hugo and Mildred, owned a ranch property and invited our family to visit them there a few times. 34, after Benioff died in 1968, Frank authored his 16-page National Academy of Sciences biographical memoir. Charlie Richter always seemed to me a disagreeable man. His biographer, Susan Ho, relates that he and his wife were committed nudists. When I saw him, he was always fully clothed. Caltech's offer was a stroke of good fortune for Frank. He was increasingly dissatisfied with life in Doc Ewing's shadow. Billy's life in Palisades was unhappy. Now with her master's degree in education, she wanted a career of her own, and there was no opportunity for one in Palisades. Also, Frank was ready for a shift in his scientific horizons. The Ewing program was ocean seismology, with the emphasis on ocean. Frank felt himself to be more a seismologist and less an oceanographer. The SeismoLab's program was global seismology, which, especially as the discoveries of plate tectonics started coming in, was where the action was. In the summer of 1955, our family moved to California. We drove across the country in our dark green Chevy station wagon. This was before the interstate highway system. Rural highways were one lane in each direction, with a single white line down the center, solid or dashed. I remember stopping in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to stay at the house of a geologist colleague of Frank's, so we must have driven most of the way across the country on US Route 66, consistent with another memory of our stopping at Petrified Forest National Monument and buying a souvenir piece of petrified wood in the gift shop. Southern California was in the middle of its post-war boom. New freeways and new suburbs were sprouting. Between 1950 and 1960, the population of Los Angeles County increased by 25%, but LA was already pretty full. Neighboring Orange County's population tripled in that decade and then doubled again in the next. In 1955, Frank, Billy, and we two kids moved into the house of a Caltech professor who was away on leave, 885 North Holliston Avenue, just north of Orange Grove Boulevard. The street was lined with tall palm trees. The house belonged to Victor Neher, a Caltech professor. Neher, then in his 50s, was one of Caltech's first PhDs. He had worked with Robert Millikan in the study of cosmic rays. Neher built instruments that were lofted by balloons to high altitudes, detecting particles that would otherwise not penetrate the atmosphere to ground level. By the 1960s, this was a backwater of physics. Particle physics, so-called, was being done with synchrotron accelerators, not cosmic rays. Neher was therefore devoting most of his efforts to teaching Caltech undergraduates. One of the physics students whom he remembered later in life was a boy from Mormon, Utah, named Kip Thorne, about whom we will hear much more later. Pasadena is separated from Los Angeles by a range of low hills, the vestigial eastern extension of the Santa Monica Mountains and Hollywood Hills that separate Los Angeles and Hollywood on the south from Burbank and the San Fernando Valley on the north. By the 1950s, Pasadena was a bedroom community for Los Angeles commuters. Earlier in the century, it had been a suburb of stately houses for the well-off, interspersed with orange groves. Altadena, an unincorporated piece of Los Angeles County in the foothills north of Pasadena, was the gateway to the Echo Mountain Resort, a 70-room Victorian hotel at elevation 3,200 feet that was reached by an incline railway. By the 1950s, this was long in the past. The hotel burned down in 1905. When I was Boy Scout age, we would hike up into the mountains following the path of the railway to the ruins of the hotel. The year we lived on Holliston, I was in second grade at Jefferson Elementary School. Billy quickly obtained her provisional California teaching credential and was teaching at the same school, a source of embarrassment to me. What I remember about that year is not school, but the freedom of owning a bicycle in a city with good sidewalks, and also the complete absence of any adult after-school supervision to an extent that seems incredible now. I ranged over about a square mile to Colorado Boulevard, Pasadena's main street on the south, and Lake Avenue, its second main street, on the west. I was forbidden to go past Lake Avenue because that was the bad part of town. Pasadena was the only city in the San Gabriel Valley in which African Americans, then called Negroes, could live, and this only west of Lake Avenue. This was de facto segregation, enforced by landlords and real estate agents. The city had two high schools. John Muir High School, west of Lake, was almost all black. Pasadena High School, at the edge of Eaton Canyon on the east, was all white. Disneyland, in Anaheim, California, opened the same summer that we moved to California. Pasadena's schools were integrated by federally mandated crosstown busing only the year after I graduated from high school in 1965. Chapter 5, Altadena. In 1956, we moved into the house at 1972 Skyview Drive, Altadena. It was the first time that Frank or Billy, or anyone in their families, had ever owned real estate property. Frank's Caltech salary was $12,000 a year, the equivalent of about $120,000 today. As an elementary school teacher, Billy earned what would be $30,000 today. Compared to any earlier time in their lives, they were well off. One block north of Skyview Drive, dry mountains jutted up out of the foothills at a rugged slope. Suburbia ended suddenly right there, with only hiking trails and jeep roads penetrating further into the mountains. One block east of our house was a sharp drop into Eaton Canyon, undevelopable land accessible only by a Forest Service road with a locked gate. Our house was built on a slope, downhill from front to back. Its improved basement was a dingy room with yellow pine paneling and a musty smell. We called it the family room, but it was mostly unused except by our pet cats, whose cat litter box added to the odor. Next to the family room was the laundry room and the garage, two cars. On the other side of the garage, directly below my bedroom, was a narrow utility room with its own outside door. The gas furnace and hot water heater were at the back. The space at the front, maybe 12 feet long and 6 feet wide, was intended as a garden shed. It became my shop, where I did projects. When I was in 4th or 5th grade, my father built for me a plywood-topped workbench, metal legs, a kit from Sears Roebuck, and nailed up a Masonite pegboard that I could hang tools on. Noyes Elementary School was a block away. The school building, a modern international design, was built in 1952, with classrooms for about 300 students. I started there in 3rd grade. Billy was now teaching full-time, 4th grade at Audubon Elementary across town. Much of her salary went to pay for our housekeeper, Mrs. Erstad, a middle-aged lady of Norwegian descent who came in afternoons. Her duties were light housekeeping, laundry, and cooking dinner for the family every weekday night, the dinner to be left warming on the stove when she departed at 5, often before Billy got home. Frank got home at 6. In principle, Mrs. Erstad was responsible for watching Paula and me after school. I was supposed to walk directly home. In reality, I just did whatever I felt like. There was an unspoken conspiracy. Mrs. Erstad wouldn't tell my mother that she never had any idea where I was, if I wouldn't. Transplanted New Yorkers, Frank and Billy embraced Southern California life with enthusiasm. For several years, this found expression as winter weekend car camping trips to the California desert, cooking on a Coleman stove, the parents sleeping in the back of the new station wagon, the kids in sleeping bags on the ground. The idea of a tent never came up, nor the idea of hiking. It was strictly drive, unpack, cook dinner, sleep, cook breakfast, drive home, repeated at various scenic spots in the Mojave Desert, Death Valley, Borrego Springs, and Joshua Tree National Monument. I somewhat appreciated the beauty of the desert and the cosmic display of stars in the night sky, but I was much more interested in the camping paraphernalia, the little needle valve and vapor generator that allowed the stove to burn gasoline without exploding, and the mantle on the gas lantern, which was prepared by burning it to an ash that was then somehow capable of surviving the gas flame while glowing white hot. The period 1957 to 58 was the United Nations designated International Geophysical Year. IGY was the consequence of a slight thaw in the Cold War, enough to allow scientific cooperation between the US and USSR. Frank was much involved. In the summer of 1958, he and Billy traveled to Russia as part of one of the first scientific delegations. Paula and I were sent to Haskell's Rascals Summer Farm Camp, located in dusty foothills, somewhere south of San Luis Obispo. We slept in large semi-permanent tents erected on wooden platforms more than a foot off the ground. That height was important because the camp was infested with rattlesnakes. Having thrown rocks at rattlesnakes in Eaton Canyon, I was not unduly worried, not so some of the other children. The adult camp counselors carried flat-bladed shovels and were adept at cornering and beheading the snakes. This happened several times in the month that Paula and I were there. Supporting the camp's flimsy claim to be a farm, every child was assigned a farm animal to feed. I chose the pigs, all 5 of them, when no other camper volunteered. I could sleep for an extra half hour every morning because, unlike the other animals, the pigs were fed after breakfast. Breakfast slops mixed into the pig feed. I loved the pigs, loved their intelligence. Winston Churchill is supposed to have said, "I like pigs. Dogs look up at us. Cats look down at us. Pigs treat us as equals." The large sow and boar were each 3 times my weight, and they delighted in knocking me over and trying to get to my chow bucket before I could empty it into the feed trough. Paula and I went back to the camp a second summer. We learned many leftist union songs, most of which are collected in familiar Woody Guthrie recordings. In 1958, the United States and the Soviet Union were each considering the ramifications of moving their nuclear weapons tests underground. The more than 500 above-ground tests, each generating a mushroom cloud of radioactive fallout, had more than doubled the amount of radioactive carbon-14 in the atmosphere worldwide. Radioactive strontium-90 from the bombs was detectable in milk and in the bones of children. Above-ground nuclear tests are visible and easily detectable. But if testing were done underground, how would each side know what the other side was doing? The answer was seismology. An underground nuclear explosion was similar to a small earthquake, but different enough in detail that it might be distinguishable from the constant global background of small earthquakes. Frank became a consultant to the President's Science Advisory Committee, chaired by MIT's President James Killian and Harvard's George Kistiakowsky. Later, under President Kennedy, Frank became a full member of PSAC. One evening in late October, at a very specific time that was known to Frank and perhaps a classified secret, our family stood at the top of our driveway in Altadena, looking to the northeast. It was a clear night. A sudden flash lit up the low horizon just over the mountains. It was over immediately. You could easily have missed it. It was the scattered atmospheric flash of one of the last open-air nuclear tests conducted by the United States, 200 miles away, at the Nevada test site. Family camping was eventually supplanted by sailing. Frank bought a 24-foot, closed cabin sailboat, a Lapworth 24, one of the first of that size with a fiberglass resin hull. Billy christened it the Frilla, for Frank, Billy, Bill, Paula. Every Saturday morning for a couple of months, my father packed us two kids, willing or not, into the back seat of the car, and we drove to the factory in San Pedro, where the Frilla was being built. I always came home itching from the loose fiberglass fibers. Even now, my skin crawls at the characteristic smell of epoxy resin. After the Frilla was in the water and Frank had taken some weeks of Coast Guard-sponsored sailing lessons, there were many weekend days when we kids were dragooned into sailing. The Frilla was moored at a grubby marina in downscale San Pedro, an hour's drive from home. I had no interest in sailing. Still, I couldn't help picking it up by osmosis. Avalon Harbor on Catalina Island was a 6-hour sail. We sometimes stayed there overnight on the boat and went to the movies in the famous, though by then decrepit, Avalon Casino, sailing back the next morning. When Frank was away on business trips, family dinners were infrequent. Instead, Billy would drive us to Bob's Big Boy or Taco Tia, Glen Bell's original taco chain, later renamed, wait for it, Taco Bell. Depending on her mood, we might eat there, or she might insist on smuggling takeout food in her purse into a movie theater, the rundown State and Rialto theaters on Colorado Boulevard being her favorites because they ran continuous double features. All movie theaters were single screen. Multiplex was far in the future. It didn't matter what movies were playing or what were their starting times or whether this was a school night. We arrived in the middle, watched the end of one movie, the whole next one, and then the start of the first. At a certain point, Billy announced, "This is where we came in," and we would exit and drive home and be sent to bed. I saw a lot of movies this way. Looking back, it is clear that Billy suffered from a bipolar mood disorder. Double features at the movies on school nights happened in periods of depression. Paula and I learned to recognize our mother's manic periods, although we didn't have a word for them. Suddenly, Billy would be involved in being our mother, unfortunately not in an emotionally supportive way, but in a mad flurry of educational activities. Billy was raised by a bad mother, and she was a bad mother herself, but she was an excellent teacher. In her manic moods, she substituted teaching, the thing she did best, for mothering. The fourth grade social studies curriculum in Pasadena included a unit on farms. I recall Billy's packing us into the back seat of the car and driving east on Foothill Boulevard past Pomona towards San Bernardino. Raymond Chandler's fictitious detective Philip Marlowe drove this route 25 years earlier in The Big Sleep. It hadn't completely changed. It was still farm country. On secondary roads, we parked on the dirt shoulder alongside fields of, to us, unknown crops, trespassed into the rows, and with a garden spade, dug up plant specimens for Billy's fourth grade class. We were digging up a large root vegetable, we didn't know what it was, when an angry farmer confronted us. Billy explained that she was a school teacher and that we were stealing his whatever it was for educational purposes. He told us that it was a sugar beet. The darker side of my mother's manic phases were when she screamed at us over trivial things. Sometimes, rarely, she hit us. More often, she fined us our allowances. "That's 2 weeks' allowance," she screamed. I often responded with what I thought was a clever, sarcastic remark. "That's 4 weeks." She marked bold X's on successive Saturdays on the wall calendar by the phone in the kitchen to indicate the weeks I would not be paid. At one point, I was in debt a whole year's allowance. she had exed every Saturday on the calendar. I never took this seriously. My allowance was withheld for a week or two at most. Then her mood would change, and for no stated reason, clemency would be granted, and I would again start getting paid. My fourth grade teacher was Mrs. Plantamura. By now, I was wearing glasses for nearsightedness, like both my parents. I was small for my age. At recess, I played exclusively with the girls, who seemed happy enough to include me, even though I could never learn to jump rope. Clarissa Plantamura, she and my mother were on a first-name basis, told my parents about this, and they became worried that I would grow up to be what was then called a sissy. They hired a catch coach for me, an athletic, masculine high school boy who came to our house two afternoons a week to teach me how to catch a baseball and, by implication, act like a real boy. It was to no avail. Yet, whatever my parents' misguided worries, throughout subsequent life, my best friends, buddies, and confidants have been predominantly female, my romantic partners, all female. The name Plantamura is Portuguese. In the early 20th century, many Portuguese immigrants came to California to work the vineyards. Mrs. Plantamura's husband's father was the leader of a brass band that traveled up and down California in the 1910s and 20s, giving concerts in town squares. In San Diego, they played in the Spreckles Pavilion, where public concerts are still held. When our class went on field trips involving long drives in a yellow Pasadena school district bus, Mrs. Plantamura had me sit next to her. On a pad of lined paper, she taught me algebra, how to move the x to the other side of the equation and then divide by whatever was multiplying it to get it to stand all by itself. I was captivated. I was also captivated by the Plantamura daughter, Carol, who at 14 was a dramatic, raven-haired teenager. I was 10. I met Carol when our family visited the Plantamuras at their home. Teenage girls, whom I knew as babysitters, interested me in general. They were so completely different from the girls I played with at school. I couldn't understand how such a transformation could take place. There didn't seem to be a corresponding change for teenage boys, who seemed simply older and cruder, extrapolations of the boys in my class with whom I didn't play at recess. I need to jump out of time to describe some events that happened decades later. In 1989, I was unexpectedly a candidate for the position of Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of California, San Diego, and traveled there for a day of job interviews. The faculty representative on the Chancellor's search committee was the department chair of the music department, one Carol Plantamura, now in her mid-40s. We recognized each other immediately. She told me that her mother, my fourth grade teacher, had died 15 years earlier. Carol was professionally a soprano who rose to lead roles in second-tier European opera houses before returning to the United States to start a new career as a music professor. She still had the dramatic demeanor that I remembered from 30 years before, and now the imposing physical build and lungs of an operatic soprano. Not surprisingly, she had a beautifully clear speaking voice. Although I quickly established that she was a great raconteur and a fellow cat lover, I didn't get the job. A few years later, my by-then ex-wife Margaret was working on her second true crime book. Margaret had already published two detective novels and one true crime book, and her new subject was a complicated Los Angeles murder case, never solved. The murder victim, D. Scott Rogo, was a journalist who wrote about parapsychology, sometimes in connection with flying saucers and Bigfoot. The police at the time had been assisted by a psychic medium named, as Margaret gleefully reported, Clarissa Plantamura. It's a very uncommon name, she pointed out. It can only be your fourth grade teacher. I phoned Carol in San Diego, with her characteristically melodious laugh. Oh yes, of course, mother had the gift. Carol explained that the whole family was gifted in this manner. She recalled a typical conversation at the dinner table. I had a good talk with Uncle Marco today, her father might say. And how is he doing? Her mother might ask. Just fine, he sends his regards. Only later did Carol figure out that Uncle Marco, and many others talked about, were ghosts. Chapter 6, Projects. Because of the baby boom, Noyes Elementary School was short of classrooms and teachers, so class sizes were large. Sometimes a teacher was assigned to teach two grades simultaneously in the same classroom, as was the case for my fifth and sixth grade teacher, Mr. Redoubt, Wally, to the other teachers, and to my mother. Mrs. Plantamura and my mother hatched the idea that I should be in Wally's combined class and that I should do 5th and 6th grades in 1 year. I would then graduate from Noyes and go on to Elliott Junior High School. I don't recall being asked for my approval of this plan. Mr. Redoubt was a fighter pilot in the Pacific in World War II. Like many veterans, he was able to go to college because of the GI Bill of Rights, and he then became an elementary school teacher. Our class had a special field trip to an airfield, I forget which, where there were airplanes from the war. Mr. Redoubt showed us the kind of plane he flew, a twin-engine P-38 Lightning. When he wasn't sailing, Frank, my father, worked on weekends. Around this time, he started taking me with him some of the time. Whether this change in habit was to provide additional relief for Billy or represented a new interest by Frank in parenting cannot be known. The Seismo Lab was still at its original location, 220 North San Rafael Avenue in the Linda Vista Hills west of Pasadena. These hills were bedrock poking up through the alluvial basin of the San Gabriel Valley. Since seismographs needed to be on bedrock, the Seismo Lab in those days couldn't be on the Caltech campus. Although purpose-built as a laboratory by the Carnegie Corporation in 1921, the two-story building was a rabbit warren of small offices, shops, hallways, and closets. Gutenberg had retired in 1957, and Frank was by now the Seismo Lab director. He had keys that opened everything. Some locked closets had seemingly not been opened since the 1920s and were filled with electrical and electronic junk from that era. Frank set me up at an unused lab bench and let me take things apart and perhaps succeed in putting them back together. Pretty soon, I was taking stuff home to work on, that is, play with, on my own shop bench in the narrow furnace room under the house. Frank bought me a soldering iron, and I learned how to use it. I have a particularly clear memory of constructing a crystal set radio under my father's supervision early in this period. Frank drew the simple circuit. It was the same circuit as his own boyhood crystal set, and he showed me how to wind the inductor coil of thin copper magnet wire around a toilet paper tube. Crystal sets have no battery. They are powered by the radio waves themselves. The key component is the crystal, or rectifier. In Frank's boyhood, this was a literal crystal of galena, a shiny lead ore, on which one tried to find a sensitive spot for a cat's whisker, a small piece of stiff wire pressed against the galena. By 1958, it was possible to use a manufactured germanium diode, poor cousin to the transistor, that was more reliable than the crystal cat's whisker combination. Frank didn't mind appropriating inexpensive things like resistors or spools of wire for me from the Seismo Lab shop, but a diode was valuable, probably the equivalent of $10 today, so we bought it at Dow Radio Supply on Colorado Boulevard. I remember that it was a 1N34. Over the next few years, I spent many Saturday morning hours taking the bus and waiting in the single parts line at Dow. Arriving in due course at the front of the line, I would present the clerk with that week's project's list of components, written in pencil in my childish printing, and he would fetch them from the shelves behind the counter. I pulled crumpled $1 bills and change from my jeans pocket to pay. My electronics hobby peaked in junior high. I subscribed to Popular Electronics. I found a junked 5-tube AM clock radio and repaired it. After that, I listened to music every night as I was falling asleep. My favorite station was the one that played Slush, Mantovani, and 1001 Strings. Bill Haley, Elvis, Chuck Berry completely passed me by. Not until 1964 did rock and roll enter my personal horizon with the Beatles. If Dow Radio was the mecca for electronics hobbyists, their Medina was C&H Surplus, a few blocks farther east on Colorado Boulevard. C&H sold whole pieces of surplus electronics equipment, possibly working, always unlabeled, from World War II and the Korean War. More useful to me, it had whole aisles of self-service bins of cheap components that had been taken out of such equipment. They also sold some non-electronic stuff, like camouflage parachute material and survival gear. Earlier, in sixth grade, my friend Glenn and I had bought a quarter of a parachute, that's how C&H sold it, and sewed camouflage bodysuits for ourselves using my mother's sewing machine and a McCall's pattern for men's pajamas from Woolworth's. Our parents thought this was cute, and even let us go out in the early evening after dark to practice survival. What they didn't know was that we were using these occasions to break into the school office at noise, plastic shim or coat hanger methods leaving no visible signs, to read the permanent records of ourselves and our classmates, which were kept in unlocked filing cabinets. I was eventually caught, not by being apprehended in the act, but by mentioning to a teacher some fact that could only have come from those files. My parents were summoned, and I was hauled before the principal. It was clear that no one knew that I was breaking and entering at night. They simply assumed that my MO was to sneak behind the counter when the school secretary was away from her desk. I don't recall what my punishment was, but the episode taught me two valuable lessons: don't get caught, and loose lips sink ships. One treasure from the Seismo Lab was 1,000 feet of used, yellow, two-conductor blasting wire. This found use when a bin of small, cheap audio loudspeakers appeared at CNH. I bought 6. Blasting wire was stiff, single-strand copper. I found that it was easy to snake it through the walls and floor spaces of our house, working only through the openings behind existing switches, outlets, and heating grates. My ostensible purpose was to wire our house for music. The project took several weeks. When it was finished, I conspicuously demonstrated to my parents that I could make music from the record player in my bedroom come out of the heating grate in any room in the house. They told me not to annoy my sister with this, and I promised not to. It took some months for my parents to discover, I think it was my mother who actually figured out, the true purpose of the project. I had found that the small audio speakers could also work in reverse, as microphones. One of my previous electronics projects was a little two-tube audio amplifier. With that, and headphones, I could listen in on any room in the house from my room. I was surprised at how angry my parents were. However, the only speaker microphone that they actually made me remove, under watchful eyes, was the one in their bedroom. Not all my projects were malign. Frank had built the family hi-fi set in the living room from a Heathkit, and he was willing to subsidize my purchase of Heathkit test equipment for my shop. What came in the box of a Heathkit was a pre-drilled chassis, an attractive outer case, hundreds of individual small electronic components, a spool of circuit wire, and a manual with hundreds of numbered mounting or soldering steps. The economic reality that enabled Heathkits was that most of the cost of manufacturing commercial electronics was in the hand labor of the point-to-point wiring and soldering, so the kits could be sold quite cheaply relative to store-bought items. Only with printed circuit boards and bulk industrial soldering methods did the Heathkit economic advantage disappear. I built a vacuum tube voltmeter, VTVM, an audio oscillator, my own hi-fi amplifier, and an oscilloscope that never completely worked. I must have made some error in wiring it. In truth, the audio oscillator's uses were not completely benign. I used it, along with the amplifier and those same little speakers, to fill the house with an ear-splitting tone at 17,000 cycles per second, not yet known as hertz. Children's ears extend to a higher range than adults, so my parents couldn't hear any sound at all. They didn't believe Paula when she complained that I was torturing her. And, yes, I had a Gilbert chemistry set and a subscription to Things of Science that provided a monthly kit of objects and artifacts for elementary science experiments. I looked forward to the arrival in the mail of its signature small blue boxes. Elliott Junior High School was built on North Lake Avenue in 1931. The building was of a boxy pink stucco, neo-mission design, complete with bell tower, by the well-regarded architectural firm Marston & Mayberry. I don't know who the most famous Elliott alumnus is, but I do know its most infamous. Sirhan Sirhan, who assassinated Robert F. Kennedy in 1968, was 2 years behind me. His picture is among the seventh graders in my ninth grade yearbook. In 1959, when I started seventh grade, the junior high school curriculum was mostly unchanged from the 1920s. All students took academic subjects, English, math, etc., and also industrial arts, shop or home economics courses. This echoed a time when ninth grade was for many a terminal year. I have clear memories of my 3 shop courses, but with a few exceptions, only vaguely remember my academic classes. In seventh grade, I took drafting, also known as mechanical drawing, The work was done on sloping tables, with sharp number 3 pencils and gum or kneaded erasers on translucent drafting paper. The tools were T-squares, plastic triangles and French curves, a compass, and a little soft brush for clearing away the eraser dust. We drew geometric forms and more complicated objects in plan and elevation orthographic views, in isometric projection, and in 2- and 3-point perspective. I never learned how to ink my drawings in India ink, the necessary step for printing the translucent drawings by sunlight onto light-sensitive blueprint paper. That would have been in the advanced drafting class, which I didn't take. I rode my bicycle 1.5 miles to school most days. In the second half of 7th grade, I took wood shop and learned to use a drill press, bandsaw, circular saw, and to some extent, wood lathe. Everyone made exactly the same projects: a tie rack with beveled edges, countersunk mounting holes, and lathe-fabricated pegs, a wooden box with mitered and pegged joints, and a sliding bottom that revealed a hidden compartment, and a third project that I forget. All the projects were done in soft pine. Hardwoods were for the advanced class. In 8th grade, boys were supposed to take welding and metal shop. I should have done that, and later regretted that I didn't. Girls took 2 semesters of home economics, mostly sewing. An elite small number of girls, 6 per class period, were allowed to take library practice, that is, work in the school library with the school librarian. Since I still, in fact always, liked the girls in my classes better than boys, I protested to the school administration that it was unfair to restrict library practice to girls and that I should be allowed into the class as the only boy. My request was granted, and I learned the wonderfully arcane rules of card catalog alphabetization and memorized large parts of the Dewey Decimal System for cataloging books. I learned to love library paste. Still, in later life, knowing how to weld and use metal cutting tools would have been more useful. In 9th grade, I took graphic arts, learning to set lead type by hand on a composing stick, picking uppercase letters from yes, the upper type case, lowercase letters from the lower case. You had to set the type backwards, right to left, and read what you had set upside down. From the composing stick, the type went into a galley tray, where it was tied up in blocks by string. You inked it with a rubber ink roller and printed a proof copy on a small horizontal press. After proofreading and fixing errors, you removed the string and locked up, i.e., clamped the type in a chase iron frame for printing on the electric motor-driven platen press. Printing was the scary part. As the space between the platen and the flatbed opened on each cycle, you stuck your hand into the gap, pulled out the just printed sheet, and with your other hand, positioned a new sheet of blank paper. Then you got your hands out of the way before they were crushed by the closing press on its next cycle. No one would allow junior high school students to do this today. Still, I never heard of a student being injured. Barely less terrifying were the massive paper trimming machines and the knives and tools used for linoleum block cutting. My 7th grade math class was the rare course not out of the 1920s. Quite the opposite. After Sputnik in 1957, a consortium of educators and professional mathematicians, the School Mathematics Study Group, known as SMSG, undertook a crash effort to modernize the grade's K-12 math curriculum. This was the famous, soon infamous, New Math. Ours was the pilot year for the 7th grade curriculum. Only one teacher, Mr. Benedict, taught the SMSG course. Most students took traditional 7th grade math. Our textbook was mimeographed and handed out in sections. The first several weeks were about set theory, an abstract topic with then no practical applications, one that had never before been taught in K-12. The SMSG developers weren't crazy, merely misguided. They felt that children were capable of learning the grand concept that mathematics was not just about numbers, but could be about any formal system of abstract objects and rules. They may have been right about this. Most of us learned set theory without difficulty. The issue was why. New math was accurately seen by the public as more geared to the rarefied worldview of pure mathematicians than to teaching something that school children needed to learn. A point at the time made caustically by the famous Caltech physics professor, Richard Feynman, about whom more later. On Fridays, Mr. Benedict devoted half the class hour to telling us War II war stories. He had been a cryptographer in the Navy, involved in the top-secret exploitation of the U.S.'s breaking the Japanese purple diplomatic code. Mr. Al Renner was my eighth-grade science teacher. His idea of a field trip was to take our class by school bus to an abandoned labyrinthine gold mine in the San Bernardino Mountains. In the pitch dark, we played sardines, a titillating game for mixed groups of adolescent boys and girls. In the summer, Renner took small groups of boys only, hiking in the Sierras. I learned to make hot rod hamburgers, meat wrapped in aluminum foil, and cooked on the engine block of the station wagon as we drove, 50 miles for medium well done. Renner was also in charge of the after-school club, the Elliott Electroneers. Obviously, I fit right in. He had relationships with local electronics companies and solicited donations of parts and cash. We had an unlimited supply of then-pricey 2N107 transistors and designed our own circuits, often not very capably. At one point, Al acquired many dozen obsolete telephone switching relays, mounted by tens on 24-inch metal strips, which would, in a telephone switch room, be mounted onto racks. I got 20 for my science fair project. I built a relay logic machine, a very primitive computer, that could almost play tic-tac-toe. Looking back, it was a pretty good effort. I had written out the whole logic tree in Boolean logic, not unrelated to the useless set theory that I learned in 7th grade SMSG math, and then used mathematical rules to simplify it as much as I could, down to the number of relays and relay poles, parallel switches that I had available. Then, there was the bar mitzvah thing. Frank and Billy were, as we have seen, atheistic Jews with socialist political leanings, fully in the liberal New York City mold. A few years after we moved to California, our family joined an ethical culture congregation. Founded by Jews in the late 19th century, ethical culture was one of several so-called godless congregational movements that met on Sundays, as if their chapters were churches. The highly regarded Fieldston School in Manhattan was founded by the ethical culture movement. Ethical culture was well known in New York City, but not well known elsewhere, especially not in California. Our congregation, which met in La Cañada, was the only one in the northern Los Angeles area. Instead of a religious service, the adults listened to a lecture on some ethical or philosophical topic, followed by time for discussion. Instead of a Sunday school religious education, we children met separately and mostly learned songs or memorized poems with unmistakable moral content. I can still sing about Commodore Gray, who had a pet dog and a pet cat who, though different species, always got along. The lay head of our congregation was Frank Thomas, then already famous as one of Walt Disney's original animators, the Nine Old Men. Thomas's creations included the stepmother in Cinderella, Captain Hook in Peter Pan, and the dancing penguins in Mary Poppins. He was responsible for the scene in Lady and the Tramp, where the two dogs fall in love over a plate of spaghetti. This all notwithstanding, suddenly, as I was approaching the age of 13, Frank and Billy decided that ethical culture was a mistake after all, and that I should be bar mitzvahed, as soon as practicable, at the Pasadena Jewish Temple. A whole family interview with Rabbi Maurice Galpert was arranged. The Pasadena Jewish Temple was the only Jewish temple or synagogue for many miles around. It and Rabbi Galpert needed to be all things to all Jewish people. Officially, the congregation was conservative, the Jewish denomination that expanded in the United States at the beginning of the 20th century as a backlash against the more liberal reform movement. However, especially with the influx of post-war immigration to California from back east, and with Caltech so nearby, there were also many reform families to be accommodated in Rabbi Galpert's flock. Services, sermons in English, were held on Friday evenings. Traditional bar mitzvahs for boys and the less traditional bat mitzvahs for girls were on Saturdays. We met in the rabbi's book-lined study. Frank explained that he had been bar mitzvahed, true, and that he and Billy had always wanted their son to be, less true. The rabbi explained that bar bat mitzvah boys and girls had been going to Sunday school for at least 2 years, and that their families had generally been members of the congregation for years more than that. "Let me speak with you privately, Dr. Press," the rabbi said to Frank. When we were ushered back into the study, a deal had been struck. I was to take weekly private Hebrew lessons from the wife of a penurious Israeli Caltech graduate student, I was to attend Sunday school for 1 year. I would be bar mitzvahed not on my date, the Saturday closest to my 13th birthday, but 5 months later, in mid-October. In Jewish tradition, this was a mark of shame. Only the stupidest children were unable to memorize their required parts of the Bible before their date. Metaphorically, this was God's punishment for my dalliance with Commodore Gray's dog and cat. A part of the deal, not revealed to me, was a financial contribution that Frank would make to the temple in lieu of years of membership. And so it came to pass. For a year's worth of Sundays, I sat next to Melanie Michaels, a girl in some of my classes at Elliott on whom I had a severe crush. Then, all the relatives came from back east for the bar mitzvah ceremony. At the reception, my male cousins and I buzzed around Mel like bees around a picnic table. I collected more than $1,000 in gift checks, a huge amount of money for me. Two follow-up stories are in the category of many years later. Margaret Geller, Josh Grindley, and I, all Harvard professors of astronomy, were sitting around at the bar mitzvah reception of another colleague's son. "How much did you give him?" Margaret, who is Jewish, asked me. $50, I said. "Right," she said. "I came up with the same figure." Josh, who isn't Jewish, chimed in that he felt that giving money was too crass. His gift was an FM transistor radio. We just stared at him. There was no use trying to explain 5,000 years of Jewish history. Separately, in the fall of 1987, I flew to Ithaca, New York, for the bat mitzvah of the daughter of my friend and colleague Saul Tucholsky, a Cornell professor, about whom more later. Rachel Tucholsky's assigned Torah readings, in English, were obscure verses of Deuteronomy that included prohibitions against 1. Building parapets with railings less than 2 cubits high, 2. Raping women captured in battle before 28 days had elapsed, 3. Punishing the children for the sins of the father, and 4. Prostrating oneself on a patterned floor. I wondered silently whether the original author had any inkling that Prohibition 3 would become a fundamental tenet of the Judeo-Christian ethic, while number 1 would evolve into a minor zoning ordinance, and numbers 2 and 4 would be seen as barbaric and risible, respectively. But when it came time for Rachel's Haftorah, the section of scripture always read that particular calendar week as part of the annual cycle of reading the Old Testament in Hebrew, she recited most clearly, Rani Akara lo Yalada. It was my Haftorah, Isaiah 54:1. Yes, it was October, and she was on her correct date. Perhaps this was part of some great plan to finally erase my shame, that particular one, at any rate. Silently, I vowed never to prostrate myself on a patterned floor. Chapter 7. Boy Scout voluntarily, I attended summer school in junior high. It was something to do instead of being bored at home on dry, hot summer days. The concentrated courses met from 9 a.m. to noon for 6 weeks. The summer after 7th grade, I took typing. Sitting in the classroom behind office-style manual typewriters, we did unending speed and accuracy drills. Despite my poor athletic coordination, I turned out to be a good typist. I later came to appreciate this course as the most useful in my entire education. The summer after 9th grade, I took second-year French, which was offered only inconveniently at John Muir High School on the bad side of town. There was a reason for this, which I will get to. I never had a regular source of income other than my allowance. I once tried delivering flyers to mailboxes for Mac's Donut Shop, half a cent per flyer, but I couldn't compete on volume with his other kid employees, who were delivering their entire stacks into a storm drain. Mac never did any quality control, and I was let go. A few times, somewhat later, I did babysitting jobs that my sister Paula turned down. The unruly Cam twins, Barky and Sasha, were closest to being regulars. Their parents were Caltech professor Barkley Cam and Linda Pauling Cam, who was the daughter of Linus Pauling, the 2-time Nobel Prize winner, Chemistry and Peace. Barkley Cam did his PhD work under Pauling and married the boss's daughter. James Watson's 1968 book, The Double Helix, describes an earlier, wild young Linda Pauling and her role as muse in the discovery of the structure of DNA. In junior high, most boys became Boy Scouts. Our required shop courses generated merit badges essentially automatically. The shop teacher had only to sign a form, so one could advance through the first few Boy Scout ranks quite easily. I was a member of Troop 1, historically the first Boy Scout troop in the San Gabriel Valley, sponsored by the Pasadena Methodist Church. I quickly went from tenderfoot to second class and then first class scout. Glenn Rankin and I were soon known as the troublemakers in the troop. The adult scoutmaster and his assistants, who included our troop's small number of older Eagle Scouts, did not hide their hostility toward us. Their animus only made us more admired by our peers. We were the rebels, the courageous individualists, the lone wolves. Well, in truth, Glenn and I divided up that responsibility. He was more the lone wolf. I was more the smart-alecky kid who was always sassing the grown-ups. We worked as a team. A lot of my authority derived from my generosity in surreptitiously distributing fireworks, firecrackers, cherry bombs, and skyrockets. Our family made trips across the border to Tijuana, irregularly but usually once or twice a year. Billy was still teaching fourth grade, and there was a Latin America unit in the curriculum. She bought souvenirs and craft items for class enrichment. My sister and I were allowed to roam freely on the main tourist shopping street. With all the money that I could save from my allowance, 77, I bought fireworks, by weight as much as 5 or 10 pounds on every trip. Bringing such contraband back across the U.S. border was illegal, but these were simpler times. There was no big drug problem, at least none acknowledged, and Tijuana was viewed as almost a neighborhood of San Diego. Our station wagon, with my cash under the back seat, was routinely waved across the border by the customs officers. Our troop, consisting of 4 patrols, each with 8 to 10 scouts, went on weekend camping trips every month or two. Almost always, we camped in the California desert, familiar to me from our family camping trips, with the difference that, in Boy Scouts, you had to carry your own sleeping bag and food in a backpack. I always took some cherry bombs and matches along for amusement on long hikes or in the evening around the campfire. Casually tossing a cherry bomb into the campfire produced generally hilarious results. However, I quickly learned that my stash was more valuable as stock in trade than for entertainment. I was able to trade firecrackers for other scout supplies at a very favorable exchange rate. My pack became much lighter once I understood this. On camping weekends, there were mandatory church services on Sunday morning. We all had to learn and recite the Methodist version of the Lord's Prayer. For Catholics, this was only the change of a few words and phrases, but Jews had to learn the whole thing from scratch. The Boy Scout camp that I went to in the summer after 7th grade on Catalina Island was named Cherry Valley. I was looking forward to helping it live up to its name, explosives-wise, but I was forewarned by a scout who had been there. Right when you got off the boat at the Catalina Isthmus, they inspected your pack for contraband. So, involuntarily, I was a model scout at Cherry Valley. I earned enough merit badges to advance in rank to Star Scout. I had only 2 ranks to go, Life Scout, and then the coveted Eagle. Once a year, 4 patrol leaders were elected democratically by the scouts in the troop. Glenn and I both decided to run for office. Our scoutmaster, Mr. Thomason, made a speech to the boys describing the qualities of a good patrol leader. They were all things in which I might be viewed as deficient. Respect for authority, courtesy to others, and religious belief were among them. He was transparently campaigning against me. When the secret ballots were counted, Glenn and I both won. I like to think that this had nothing to do with the fact that the tellers, the 2 scouts who counted the ballots, were friends of ours, and that we had promised them many cherry bombs if we both won. I became patrol leader of the Ram Patrol, Glenn, leader of the Bears. It was a great year for Troop 1 before the adults did finally come to their senses and expel me from scouting. My patrol had off-book meetings, just us kids. We experimented with Drano bombs. We taught ourselves to build match throwers, simple devices made from spring clothespins that, when cocked and triggered, would simultaneously ignite a kitchen match and propel it, flaming, with a range of 10 feet or more. We took long hikes in the storm drains that ran beneath the streets of Altadena. Separate from the sanitary sewers, they were relatively clean and almost always dry. We explored, and we drew and distributed maps. Ironically, it was the storm drains, not the fireworks, that got me kicked out of scouting. On one of our covert hikes in the underground storm drains, Billy Thomason, our scoutmaster's son, got stuck between the iron bars of a massive debris gate that the rest of us were able to shimmy through. He panicked and started crying, shaking off all attempts to free him. It was obvious that, when he calmed down, he would be able to back out of the grate exactly as he got in. We left him with a flashlight. Unfortunately, when he did get home, unharmed, he told his father everything. That was it for my scouting career. I never got the chance to go for Eagle Scout. Later in life, I met and worked with many former Eagle Scouts, often retired senior military officers, and came to understand that their concepts of honor and leadership were somewhat different from mine, and that I might not have fit in well among their number. In ninth grade, I took an elective journalism class. What stands out about that class had little to do with journalism. It was in Mr. Clement's class that I fell in love with Melanie Michaels, whom I had sat next to in Sunday school for a year. This was a love far beyond anything that I had felt for her at the Pasadena Jewish Temple. This was my first true, and eventually, first reciprocal love. It was innocently platonic. We got no farther than holding hands. School and after-school activities brought us together. We were both elected to the student council. Mel was elected secretary. I was something called traffic commissioner, which was about appointing the student hallway monitors who wore bright green triangular sashes as badges of office. And we were co-editors of the school newspaper, Husky Highlights. In one issue, we made ourselves Boy and Girl of the Month. Even Mr. Clement was surprised at this forwardness. We went to school dances together, something I had never done before. My parents were suddenly forgiven for having made me take dancing lessons in the Galatz Cotillion in seventh grade. Probably the only example of overt anti-Semitism that I experienced growing up had to do with those seventh grade dancing lessons. Most of the middle class kids in my school took dancing lessons at the Altadena Cotillion, sponsored by the Altadena Country Club. If your parents were not members of the country club, any other member could sponsor you. Jews, however, were not welcome. Instead, Jewish children schlepped to the ballroom at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium where Miss Galitz held her competing cotillion of mostly Jews. I was about as good at dancing as I was at sports. Poignantly, my crush on Melanie was doomed true love. It had been announced that neighborhood school boundaries were being redrawn and that a small number of Elliott Junior High students would, because of where they lived, graduate not to Pasadena High School with the rest of us, but to John Muir High School on the other side of town. The Michaels family lived at the top of Lake Avenue and were in that small number. At the final school dance, Mel and I clung tightly to each other, even as we danced awkwardly. Our special song was Misty. So that is why, after ninth grade graduation, I insisted on taking summer school second year French at John Muir High School. Melanie and I had agreed that she would sign up for the same course so that we could continue to be together at least for the summer. She never showed up. The class read Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince, actually in French. Our teacher, Mr. Swan, claimed to have worked at Brentano's in Paris and to have once sold a book to Ernest Hemingway, perhaps dubious assertions. During my high school years, I did encounter Melanie randomly a couple of times around Pasadena, but, and I really hope this is an original turn of phrase, the magic was gone. A few years after that, I heard that she had dropped out of college and was a topless dancer in the Hate in San Francisco. She did have the upper body prerequisite for that line of work, but I never tracked her down to check on what was surely a malicious rumor. Chapter 8, High School. My high school locker was on an outside wall of the music building next to the gym. I was getting books from my locker during the class break at 10:55 a.m. on November 22, 1963, when I heard that President Kennedy had been shot. That open locker and its contents, at that exact moment, became a permanent visual memory. The Pasadena High School campus was built for 4,000 students. During my time there, trailer-like temporary classrooms were already being built in the parking lot for the baby boomer overflow enrollment. My high school class had 1,500 students. Pasadena High School had in its history graduated a few famous alumni: General George S. Patton, Howard Hawks, the film director, Edwin McMillan, the Nobel laureate in chemistry. Any ordered list becomes rapidly less famous after that, and they are mostly minor sports figures. There was no sense of history or tradition in the school. We were baby boomer adolescents living in an eternal present. Anne Roosevelt, a granddaughter of Franklin and Eleanor, was in my high school class and wrote a nice note in my 11th grade yearbook. Although de facto racially segregated, PHS otherwise drew on a cross-section of Pasadena. My yearbooks show classmates with Hispanic, Japanese, Italian, Irish, and Jewish names, interspersed among the Protestant majority and Catholics minority. There are a lot of Armenian names. What is striking to me, and would be almost unimaginable today, is how little sense of ethnicity and social class we students had at the time. Families moving to Southern California during the 1950s and 1960s boom years were leaving such labels behind. In place and time, these were peak years for the melting pot. Identity politics was not just a term then unknown, it was un-American and unthinkable. At high school reunions in the decades following, it was sobering to watch our self-invented social structure slowly fade. It was still there vestigially. Rick Osborne, our handsome star athlete and valedictorian, held court at reunions decades later, along with his hovering sidekick, Mark Swed. Outside of reunions, Rick had dropped out of college, taken up drugs, they said, and became, I heard, a carpenter, while Mark was the chief music critic for the Los Angeles Times and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. But we could not escape out ethnic and socioeconomic identities, it turned out. By my 25th reunion in 1990, Susie Feinstein, whom I had known since 8th grade library practice, was more Jewish than I ever recalled. Linda Jacobs had a PhD and turned out to be from a wealthy Lebanese-American family. Amy Uematsu had become a poet and a voice of the Japanese-American experience. Her parents were interned in the camps during World War II, who knew? In adult life, my classmates had acquired hyphenated identities. During 10th and 11th grades, we learned where we fit in this academic hierarchy, learned indirectly by what cohort of students turned up repeatedly assigned with us to the same classes. Behind the scenes, invisibly, we were being sorted into academic tracks. The best students were assigned to the best teachers. The best teachers taught only the best classes. It was a great system if you were in the top group, and of course, white. By the start of my senior year, the big pond of 1,500 had, for most purposes, shrunk to a group of 100 or so of us who knew each other well, were on our way to good colleges, and in matters of student influence, ran the school. We were, by then, the big fish. In 10th grade, driver's ed was the most important class. If you took driver's ed in school, you could get a learner's driving permit at age 15 and a half. For me, the magic date was November 23, 1963. This turned out to be a Saturday, the day after President Kennedy was shot. Still, my father drove me to the Department of Motor Vehicles office in Pasadena. We filled out the form and waited in a long line. The clerk pointed to a line left blank on the form. Both parents need to sign. Without missing a beat, Frank said, "His mother is waiting in the car. I'll go get her to sign." We went outside. Frank forged my mother's signature on the form, in a handwriting quite different from his own, and I soon had my permit. In his long career as a scientist, later White House advisor, and then president of the National Academy of Sciences, Frank was known as the straightest of straight arrows. But we in the family knew that there were occasions like this when he could be quite bent. Soon after that, with a loan of infinity months of allowance from my parents, which I knew would eventually be commuted to time served, I was driving my own new Honda S65 motorcycle. Barely deserving the name, the S65 was really a motorbike with only a 65 cubic centimeter engine. The attraction was that its design had motorcycle pretensions. Apart from my not having to take the school bus anymore, one of the biggest changes my Honda effected was providing fast access to the main branch of the Pasadena Public Library. In elementary school and junior high, my cruising range by bicycle included only the Santa Catalina branch, whose collection got me through the entire series of Freddie the Pig books. What I liked about them is obscure to me now, and all the Dr. Dolittles. I was able to read Nancy Drew books only at friends' houses, since the public library considered them unworthy children's literature. Ditto for Hardy Boys mysteries, although I didn't like them much anyway. I owned a small collection of the also deemed unworthy Tom Swift Jr. books. That led a sympathetic librarian to direct me to higher quality juvenile science fiction, Ellen McGregor's eponymous Miss Pickerel series, Carl Biemler's Magic Ball from Mars, Eleanor Cameron's Mushroom Planet series, and ultimately to the juvenile science fiction novels of Robert Heinlein. In the 1940s, Heinlein had written exclusively for adult science fiction magazines, but in 1947, the famous children's books editor at Scribner's, Alice Dalglish, convinced him to try his hand at a novel for older children, a market that would later become known as young adult. His rocket ship Galileo was published in 1947. After that, new Heinlein juveniles came out about annually. I discovered them in the Santa Catalina branch, about when Have Spacesuit Will Travel, the last in the series, had just been published. I rocketed through the whole series. The plots, in various futuristic but painstakingly scientifically accurate settings, generally involved conflict between a teenage boy and his parents or other authority figures. I leave you to guess who prevailed in every case. Dalglish and Heinlein were often at odds over his wanting to introduce more adult themes into the books, read POLITICS and SEX. His penultimate juvenile novel, Citizen of the Galaxy, 1957, was judged by the Santa Catalina Branch Library as too intense for the juvenile section because of its themes of slavery and forced marriage, ritual rape being strongly implied. It was classified as adult science fiction, and I had to provide a note from my mother before I could read it. By the time I was riding my Honda to the Central Library on Walnut Street in downtown Pasadena, where there were no restrictions on what I could check out, Heinlein had parted ways with Dalglish and was publishing adult sci-fi novels about yearly. I was on the library's waiting list for each. Stranger in a Strange Land, 1961, with themes of free love, teleportation, and the eventual emergence of a Nietzschean master race, one of Heinlein's favorite motifs, is considered his most influential work. Charles Manson, whose followers murdered actress Sharon Tate and others in 1969, reportedly modeled his cult on the book. It is hard to describe, let alone explain, the lifelong effect that Heinlein had on a whole male generation of technically minded baby boomers. The stereotypical libertarianism of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs owes as much to Heinlein as it does to the more often cited Ayn Rand. Years later, when I got to know this crowd, I frequently heard echoes of Heinlein in their conversation, and I sometimes would ask, "Were you a Heinlein fan?" Of course. Rand and Heinlein both postured as uncompromising laissez-faire capitalists, but they were different. Rand's protagonists demonstrated heroism by glorifying their individual integrity above the common good. Heinlein's heroes did the integrity thing, yes, but their heroism contrived to solve the future world's problems. Politically, Rand was anti-interventionist. By contrast, Heinlein had been a naval officer and engineer in the 1930s. Several of his works, notably Starship Troopers, 1959, trot out the right-wing idea that only blooded war combat veterans should be allowed to vote, because they alone could understand the value of the franchise. But before swinging to the extreme right, Heinlein was a self-described FDR liberal, and there are traces of that here and there in the novels. His Nietzschean supermen and sexually available superwomen often worked to benefit the unwitting masses of little people. How could teenage boys in the 1960s possibly be taken in by this right-wing, bordering on fascistic claptrap? The question is more, how could we not be? We, after all, were going to be the supermen, and we hoped to soon meet the superwomen, especially the ones who, in the adult novels, were constantly in a state of undress. As avid a fan as I was, I can make the case that I was not completely taken in. I was not politically unaware. I read Walter Lippmann's column every week in my parents' Newsweek subscription. I was a member of the Foothill Young Democrats and stuffed envelopes for Lyndon Johnson's campaign against Barry Goldwater in 1964. Heinlein was forbidden fruit. I started winning math competitions in 11th grade. Second place in giving a short math lecture at Cal Poly State College. First place in the problem-solving test at Occidental College. The prizes were either math books or slide rules, sometimes expensive ones. I still have a drawer full of slide rules, now useless except as objects of nostalgia. My chemistry teacher, Mr. Sadoff, tutored me after school for the American Chemical Society National Chemistry Contest. I placed fourth in Southern California, one place below the rank that went on to the national competition. My score did get me invited, along with Mr. Sadoff, to the National Youth Conference on the Atom in Chicago. We were sponsored by the Southern California Edison Company, which was uncritically promoting the benefits of its nuclear power stations. Our pictures were in the Pasadena Star News. Between 11th and 12th grades, I participated in a residential summer physics program at Cornell University in Ithaca, one of several science programs around the country sponsored by the National Science Foundation, another post-Sputnik initiative. Many later distinguished scientists were students in these influential summer programs. In giving an experience in science research to students the summer before they were applying to colleges, NSF had hit a sweet spot. Except for summer camp and staying with grandparents, this was the first time I lived away from home. Far above Cayuga's waters, two dormitories, a boys' and a girls', were given over to high school students in this and other programs at Cornell. There were 36 of us in the physics program. My roommate was Ben Orlov from New York City. We ate in Willard Strait Hall with the college-age summer school students. There was a girl that I liked, Judy Lieberman, whom I would meet again later at Harvard and for 50 years afterwards, and I worked up the courage to invite her on a movie date. The film was Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, not exactly a feel-good movie. I was clueless. I won various math awards in 12th grade and accumulated a lot more slide rules. I had the highest score in Southern California on the National Math Contest exam, sponsored by the Mathematical Association of America. But it was a mediocre score compared to the best students in, say, New York City or even Northern California. I commuted on my motorcycle to Pasadena City College for its first-year calculus class. There were too few students at PHS for the class to be offered there. We used the famously abstract textbook by Caltech professor Tom Apostle, a poor choice because it was mostly useless in preparing for the National College Advanced Placement exam. My father gave me his college calculus textbook, written in the 1920s, to study independently. Calculus is unchanging, but the way that it is taught changes appreciably from generation to generation. In this respect, it is like Shakespeare. Frank brought home also a copy of the new Feynman Lectures in Physics, a book that was generating a buzz not just at Caltech, where Dick Feynman was a professor, but nationally. Feynman's approach was quirky and brilliant. I was enormously influenced by the book and its two later volumes, first as a student and later as a professor of physics. My College Board test scores were all well into the 99th percentile, except for German with a 98. I applied to MIT, Yale, Harvard, and Berkeley. My application essay included the alarming sentence, 20 years from now, I would like to be a professor of theoretical physics or of mathematics in a preferably large university. All four schools admitted me. Ed Coliani from John Muir High School, who had been an Elliott electroneer with me in junior high school, was admitted and went with me to Harvard. We were the only two from the city of Pasadena in our Harvard class. In a freshman class of just over 1,000, Harvard admitted just 29 students from the greater Los Angeles area, with only about half accepting admission. Only about half of my high school class went on to college at all, most of those to Pasadena City College, which offered a 2-year associate's degree. Margaret Lauritsen was a girl I knew from 7th grade math class. She had disappeared when her family moved to a different junior high school district and reappeared only in my senior year of high school. The year before, she was in Denmark. Her father, a Caltech physics professor, was on leave at the Niels Bohr Institute. Tommy Lauritsen had been Niels Bohr's postdoc in Copenhagen just before World War II, and he was still a close friend and colleague of Bohr's son Åge, also a physicist. Margaret wore long skirts and loose peasanty blouses, like some lost village girl from a Grimm's fairy tale. Her long, light brown hair was woven into a thick single braid. It was logical that Margaret and I should end up paired in the senior year social hierarchy. Our fathers were both Caltech professors. We were both socially awkward. We were both good at math, from Mr. Gao. Benedict's 7th grade new math class, we both knew some set theory. We fell in love. What else could we do, really? We shared ingenious math puzzles from Martin Gardner's column in Scientific American. Margaret taught me to play Go, the game with black and white stones on a wooden grid. We were both duffers. Together we discovered Cat's Cradle, the string game, and found in the library whole volumes written by anthropologists full of instructions for recreating the string figures and associated games of the Polynesians. The Polynesians. You can't get more romantic than the Polynesians. I had read Margaret Mead in social studies class. Chapter 9. Getting to Harvard. My parents pushed me to apply for summer jobs, what today would be internships, at several national laboratories, and I was offered a job for 10 weeks in the Burge Powell Experimental Physics Group at the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory, located on the hill overlooking the Berkeley campus. My salary was $75 a week, the equivalent today of about $15 an hour. The official letter that I got, drafted in the lab's employment office, made it sound like a real job, specifying working hours, benefits, none, basically, and so on. At the bottom of the letter, Burge or Powell, I forget which, had written in pen, "Pay no attention to the above. You can do as much or as little as you like." Rather than drive me to Berkeley, about an 8-hour drive, my father drove me to LA Airport and handed me an airplane ticket and cab fare for the ride from Oakland Airport. I struggled to manage a 40-pound suitcase, a portable typewriter, and a loose pile of books. Described in this way, my parents' attitude sounds unfeeling. I think it was simply a sign of their confidence in me. The next 10 were the loneliest weeks in my life, possibly even in my life since. The work was interesting. I taught myself to program in Fortran, keyboarding IBM cards on the IBM 026 punch card machine and then submitting the deck at the computer center window, to be run on the giant IBM 744 computer, a machine vastly less powerful than today's smartwatches, probably less powerful than a high-end toaster. There were two bubble chamber groups at the Rad Lab. A bubble chamber was a device, about the size of a small truck, for photographing the paths and decays of particles, protons, electrons, and things more exotic, from the then-giant particle accelerator, the Bevatron. The group doing outstanding work that soon won Nobel Prizes was the Alvarez group. We will meet Luis Alvarez at length later in my story. Burge Powell was the second-rate group. I didn't understand this at the time, of course. Burge was 78 years old. Powell was in his mid-60s. Both were over the hill. The work of the group was de facto supervised by two younger physicists, George Kalmus, a Brit, and Bob Ely, an American. Each took a modest interest in what I did during working hours. Kalmus told me that, when he was a child in England during the war, there were no raspberries for jam, but there was a company that made fake berry seeds out of wood chips for inclusion in the artificially flavored jelly. I made no attempt to meet anyone socially. I had no idea how to. I went to free music recitals and concerts. I spent Saturday and Sunday mornings in the Morrison Library's music listening room, which had turntables, headphones, and an extensive record collection. I went to movies alone. I read books of Shaw plays. I made lists of courses in the Harvard catalog that I hoped to take in the next 4 years. Margaret and I wrote to each other daily, and we pledged our mutual and undying love. She visited me at Berkeley just once, with her parents, when she was moving into her freshman dorm at the early start of the fall semester. She would be at Berkeley while I was at Harvard. I had decided to go to Harvard secure in the knowledge that I would be leaving my parents 3,000 miles behind in Pasadena. In the middle of that summer, Frank announced that he was leaving Caltech for MIT, where he would become the department head of Earth and Planetary Sciences. He and Billy must have known about this for many months, but Paula and I had been kept in the dark. My precious possessions. Stuff. In Altadena would be packed by anonymous movers and shipped to storage in Boston, where it would be inaccessible to me until my parents bought a house there. In the meantime, they rented a tiny house in Cambridge with a bedroom for Paula, who was entering high school at the Buckingham School. But, aside from a sofa bed in the living room, no space for me. In the same burst of communication, my father told me what financial support I might expect from now on. He would pay my tuition, room, board, and laundry. I was expected to pay for everything else out of summer earnings or term-time jobs. He did not ask me to pay back the 25 weeks that I was in arrears on allowance, commenting only, "That's between you and your mother." Thus was I cast out into the world at age 18, not exactly marooned, not exactly penniless, not exactly orphaned, but with quasi-elements of all three. I was quasi on my own. My two priorities were to embrace Harvard undergraduate life with the fervor that I had previously shown for learning calculus, and to embrace Margaret with the fervor, etc., etc. These priorities were on opposite coasts, unfortunately. Harvard. It is the single institution that most influenced my life. I was an undergraduate from 1965 to 1969, went away for just 7 years, and returned as a full professor to stay for another almost 25. It is fair to say that, to the extent institutions can be understood at all, I know the place. Institutions have a brain, and they also have a gut. The brain of Harvard, the president, deans, and faculty, is in the business of higher education and research. The gut of Harvard, the traditions, the buildings, the creaky processes and procedures, the admissions office, the non-academic workforce, the 50,000 living alumni of the college, is in a compatible but different business, the training of young people for membership in the elite power structure of the United States and, to some extent, world. That function has flourished through three centuries. I was one of about 1,000 incoming freshmen. We were assigned to dorms in and around the Harvard Yard. Upperclassmen lived in the houses closer to the Charles River. My roommates were Randy Chase, who grew up in New York City and graduated from elite Fieldston, and John Moretti, who grew up in a tough Catholic neighborhood in Cleveland. John was one of Harvard admission's obvious experiments in upward social mobility. He had what looked like knife scars on his chest and back. In the week before older students arrived, the 1,000 of us were supposed to meet each other and learn the rules. Closer to the truth, the preppies, about half the class, met each other, and, separately, we and the other half of the class met each other. This divide diminished in subsequent years, but never disappeared. On my side of the divide, I derived instant status by having been Ben Orlov's roommate at Cornell the previous summer. He was already a legend in our class. In his senior year of high school, he did 8 advanced placement exams and got 5s, the highest grade, on all of them. And that was not something that preppies would admire at all. I soon learned that most of my classmates were not, by my standards, terrifically smart. This was a shock to me. However, they were all terrifically something. That was how Harvard admissions worked. You had to be smart enough to probably not flunk out. Only 50 or so of us 1,000 would fail to graduate, albeit some taking an extra year. Above that threshold, smart didn't count for much. What mattered, according to lore, was that you excelled in some particular thing, whether academic, athletic, political, literary, musical, artistic, or oddball other. I now think that this conventional wisdom was retrofitting an explanation to the hidden truth already mentioned, that the admissions process had been tuned, literally over centuries, to populate the power elite. The fact that students already all excelled in something was the symptom, not the disease. The disease was their future success. President Pusey held a reception for the incoming class, jacket and tie mandatory. There was a formal receiving line, the first I had ever seen. You spoke your name to the first person in the receiving line, the assistant dean of freshmen, say, who would in turn introduce you by name to the next person, and so on. Our dorm proctor drilled us in advance on the protocol. I was fascinated by the fact that errors could propagate and accumulate, so that by the time you reach the end of the line, with the highest-ranking dignitaries, your name might be completely garbled, and it would be bad manners to correct it. It might as well have been a metaphor for the elite that I was being groomed for. Undergraduate organizations came door-to-door in the freshman dorms recruiting new members. Jim Roosevelt knocked for the Young Democrats. I mentioned that I knew his sister Anne in Pasadena. A political recruiter from farther left queried, as if it was the most ordinary question in the world, "Are you Mao or Trot?" I had no idea what he was talking about. I joined something called Verein Termvector, the Harvard German Club. They met for dinners and good conversation, for which my high school German was, alas, insufficient. I did become their volunteer projectionist and watched many German movies with English subtitles from the projection booth in Emerson Hall. Organizations like the Harvard Crimson, the newspaper, Harvard Lampoon, the humor magazine, Harvard Advocate, the literary magazine, or WHRB, the radio station, sought undergraduates who would devote themselves to their respective organizations' body and soul. The pitch was subtle: sign up for our competition, and perhaps we'll invite you to be a member. I signed up for WHRB. I had heard that you pretty much had to be a preppy to get into the Crimson, Lampoon, or Advocate. My first year physics was taught by a young assistant professor, Daniel Kleppner. Kleppner later became an MIT professor and a founder of the field of ultra-cold atomic physics. He was often talked of as a possible Nobel Prize recipient, but he never won one. I was completely lost for the first month or so of his course, but then, suddenly, everything clicked and I could do it all. My math course was second-year calculus, but it was the version for scientists, not the version for would-be math majors, which I had thought myself to be. A student math advisor, a Radcliffe student named Claire Max, warned me that the course for concentrators, Harvard's term for majors, was too hard for any freshman from a public school that wasn't the Bronx High School of Science. Claire, at the time a sophomore, ultimately became a famous astronomer. We became friends decades after this first interaction, of which she has no memory. I could take pretty much any other two courses I wanted, so I did two history courses. The large lecture course in East Asian history and culture was normally taught by John Fairbank, the lectures on China, and Edwin Reischauer, the lectures on Japan. However, while on leave as U.S. ambassador to Japan, Reischauer had been stabbed by a Japanese anarchist and contracted hepatitis. So Albert Craig, a lesser light, took over his lectures. In the late 1940s, Fairbank was one of the old China hands, accused of disloyalty to the United States because they predicted, correctly, the success of Mao and the Communist Party. Fairbank was considered the leading China scholar in the United States in the post-war period. I found this course almost impossibly difficult. East Asian history was my first introduction to a real Harvard course, one with hundreds of pages of reading every week and the memorization of hundreds of names and dates, then requiring on exams the requirement to integrate all these facts into coherent, well-supported arguments. I was used to multiple-choice exams. This was very different. The course also gave me a new respect for preppies. They, at least some of them, could actually do this. They knew how to study. I had no idea, made obvious by my first semester grade, a C+. My other history course, English Social History, years 400 to 1648, was the opposite in every possible way. The class was small, less than 30 students. It was taught by George Homans, a charming man from a distinguished old Boston family, himself a great-great-grandson of John Quincy Adams and a Harvard lifer. He matriculated at the college in 1928, and other than for service as a naval reserve officer in World War II, never left. Although it was an upper-level course, there were no prerequisites. There was hardly any reading. Homan's delightful lectures were not just filled with charming anecdotes. That was all there was to them. I learned that the song, "Oats, Peas, Beans, and Barley Grow," referred to the rotation of crops in medieval strip farming. That Hrolf the Walker, a Dane who invaded Normandy in 9/11, was so called because he was too fat to ride a horse. That Ivar the Boneless, he must have done something, but I now forget what. There was a midterm exam that one could elect not to have counted, and a short-term paper. I audited two courses taught by distinguished professors, if not quite at the Fairbank Reischauer level. Politics and Society was taught by Seymour Lipset, an eminent sociologist and theorist of American democracy, and later an early neoconservative. The history of 18th and 19th century Europe was taught by Crane Brinton, a leading historian of France, and a recent past president of the American Historical Association. Lipset's course was difficult. His lectures were dense. I was glad not to be taking it for a grade. Brinton's lectures were much like George Homans, long on charm and short on rigor. In later years, the course taught at 11 a.m. became known as Brunch with Brinton. The local term for such courses was GUT. GUT courses were Harvard's way of ensuring that the less intellectually brilliant future leaders of America had a path through the college to a decent grade point average and to a degree, not in an unsavory field like physical education or communications, majors that did not exist at Harvard, but rather a respectable major of entirely gut courses in government and history. Much later, as a Harvard professor, I taught such a course myself, Astronomy 1. Chapter 10, Radio Days WHRB, which insiders knew to pronounce as WHERB, had captured me in a major way. I spent many hours at the radio station, comping, that is, being trained for full membership. The studios, so-called, were a rabbit warren of half a dozen rooms in the basement of Claverly Hall, a part of Adams' house. In the comp, one had to declare a major and minor field. Mine were classical music, called CM, and controlling. CM meant constructing future broadcasts from the station's large, but not unlimited, access to classical LP records. Controlling, known more formally as studio engineering, meant being on the other side of the glass from the announcer and operating the turntables, tape recorders, and the many switches and knobs on the console. At sign-off, WHRB played not the national anthem, as did all other Boston radio stations, but Fair Harvard. A very small number of WHRBs, Werbys, went on to noteworthy careers in broadcasting. Best known from my Harvard class is Chris Wallace, Fox News, but he was special from the start as the son of broadcast journalist Mike Wallace. From other epochs, Bruce Morton and Scott Horsley, NPR, were in their times nationally familiar names. Martin Bookspan, a couple of decades before me, became the voice of the New York Philharmonic. New Yorker music critic Alex Ross was a couple of decades after me. I give this list not because it is impressive, but because it is so thin. A corresponding list of Harvard Crimson alumni would go on for pages and include U.S. presidents as lesser lights. There was something willingly proletarian and anti-establishment about WHRB. I could sense it. I loved it. Progressive journalist Sam Smith, who was a Arby in the late 1950s, once wrote, WHRB functioned as a counter-fraternity, a salon de refuse for all those who, because of ethnicity, class, or inclination, did not fit the mold of Harvard. Other organizations sought students of the right type. WHRB got what was left over. By the late 1960s, nothing had changed. The radio station became my home, social network, and emotional support system. Later in life, I noticed that my natural roles in larger institutional settings often unconsciously mimicked positions that I had at HRB. The radio station became, unknowably at the time, a template for my professional life. At WHRB, I was regarded as someone who could do almost any job for a short time, but with the single exception of my quickly becoming classical music director, did not have the necessary attention span to advance through the established hierarchy. I was several times acting chief engineer, acting program director, acting station manager, you get the idea, all of which I did well enough to be invited back the next time an acting was needed. I was a talented pinch hitter and a poor team player. Spoiler alert, and so ever since. Early in December, I was invited to a sort of tea with Mrs. Bunting, as she was called, the president of Radcliffe. 20 or so of us Harvard freshmen were invited, but to our disappointment, no Radcliffe women. From my summer job in Berkeley, I knew that Dr. Mary Bunting was an accomplished scientist who had recently served as a presidential appointee on the Atomic Energy Commission. Notwithstanding, she came across to us as a kindly aunt, asking us questions about how we liked Harvard and giving us advice on the best ways to meet Cliffies. She was open about the differences between Harvard and Radcliffe admissions. Harvard liked to gamble, she said, and to take chances on students from diverse backgrounds. Radcliffe preferred to admit a homogeneous class of girls who, often like their mothers, were sure to succeed at Radcliffe. Having made that choice, Radcliffe could be more liberal in its rules because, in the homogeneous population, there would on average be fewer behavioral outliers. I liked Mrs. Bunting's use of a statistical argument about the tales of distributions to make her point. She stepped down as Radcliffe president 7 years later, by which time the niceties of her statistics were completely swept away by events of the later 1960s. Soon after that, the Radcliffe admissions office would cease to exist. Harvard admitted both men and women, and it continued to gamble on diversity, now for both sexes. Apart from the radio station, my circle of friends was limited. Randy, John, and I, as roommates, spent endless hours in bullshit discussions of every conceivable subject and made many joint trips to Elsie's sandwich shop for roast beef specials, rare roast beef piled high on a Kaiser roll with relish and onion. It cost 50 cents, about $4 today, but our friendship didn't go beyond that. All three Ewing kids from Lamont were at Harvard that year, Peter Ewing in my class, but they were on the far side of the preppy-non-preppy divide. That I mostly hung around with Ben Orlove from Cornell Summer and Ed Coliani from Pasadena shows how bad I was at making new friends. I was elected a full member of WHRB early in January. Math and Chinese history as full-year courses took up from where they left off. In physics, the subject was no longer mechanics, but now electromagnetism, taught by Edward Purcell, who had won the 1952 Nobel Prize in Physics for his discovery of nuclear magnetic resonance, the physical phenomenon behind MRI medical imaging. Ed Purcell and my father had served together on President Kennedy's Science Advisory Committee. Purcell's course used his own textbook, a volume in the Berkeley Physics course, another post-Sputnik project sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Purcell was a brilliant lecturer, yet soft-spoken and meticulous. He never pulled a rabbit out of the hat or sprang the surprising answer. Many physics lecturers did do that. Physicists always like to prove that they are the smartest people in the room. When Purcell reached a result on the blackboard, you knew exactly how he had gotten there. You had learned something. He made you feel that you were the smartest person in the room. I needed a course to fill the slot previously occupied by Homan's English Social History. Before final study cards were due, I visited several: a linguistics course, an economics course, a literature course on Dostoevsky. In the end, I signed up again with George Homans. Spring semesters, he taught a sociology course, Introduction to the Study of Small Groups, an entertaining gut, much in the mold of his history course. I knew I had made the right choice when the student sitting next to me pointed out the whole Harvard football team by name and starting position. The reading list included a lot of B.F. Skinner, the Harvard professor and pioneer of modern behaviorism, including his utopian novel Walden 2. Homans always referred to Skinner in class as Fred. And then Gen Ed A, the composition course. What? You thought that I chose to place out of English composition class when offered the chance? A shameful admission for a budding physicist, but I actually enjoyed writing. The honors sections were all different. I had requested the same science-themed section as Ben Orlove, but was mistakenly assigned to another section that met at the same time. My section lady was a graduate student of Harvard professor Eric Erickson, the polymath psychologist psychoanalyst whose own psychoanalysis had been under Anna Freud in Vienna in 1933. We were assigned Erickson's Young Man Luther, a psychoanalytic biography, and were then supposed to choose our own historical figure and write our own, much shorter biography, informed if not by psychoanalysis, then by some other identifiable discipline. I wrote something on the Hungarian-American physicist Leo Szilard, ghostwriter of the famous Einstein letter to Roosevelt that produced the Manhattan Project. My essay wasn't very good, but instead of giving me a bad grade, my section lady returned it to me and asked me to submit something completely different. I complied maliciously by writing a reasonably good essay on the manifest flaws of Eric Erickson's psychoanalytic method. She graded it an A without commenting, and I got an A for the course. I was learning classical music by scheduling for broadcast pieces I had never heard, by composers that I knew nothing about, and then listening to them for the first time when they were on the air. My other work for the radio station's classical music department was writing features, one-hour weekly shows on a particular theme, like music of the 20th century or choral masterworks. You picked one or more works and then wrote 4 to 6 minutes of script that was read by the announcer in appropriate segments and supposed to educate the listener. Faking this kind of knowledge was easy. I became facile with the 10-volume Groves Dictionary of Music and Musicians, and there was always the record jacket copy as backup. Radio work imparts the discipline of working to a deadline. If my feature was scheduled for 8 o'clock, then, whether or not I was there with a script, the controller would start the theme music rolling at 8:01 right after the Western Union beep, which went over the air automatically at 8. At 8:20, the controller would fade the theme music and cut to the announcer, who had to have a script to read. 5 minutes late was not good enough. This was a life's lesson. Some commitments are work to quality. In these, what is important is not primarily when they are completed, but how good is the final product. Scientific research papers are like this, but other commitments are work to deadline. You do your best, but if the quality is not up to snuff, then too bad, the show must go on. I soon figured out that almost everything required of me by Harvard was in the work to deadline category. I became adept at titrating the quality of my work to A or A grades in math and physics, B plus or B in my other subjects, and to spend the minimum possible time to achieve just those grades, finishing just at the respective deadlines. I tried never to work harder than necessary. Still, for the sake of WHRB's listeners, I felt that it would be good for me to actually know something about the music I was forcing on them. So I audited Harvard's one-semester music appreciation course, the famous Music 1, History of Western Music. This course had been given since the 1930s, taught since 1954 by the same lecturer, G. Wallace Woodworth. Except for 1 year of study in England, Woody Woodworth had been at Harvard since his freshman year in 1920. He was not a serious scholar, but year after year after year, he was able to muster a remarkable degree of on-stage enthusiasm in his lectures to 300 students. On the stage in the music department's biggest lecture hall, he raced between the podium, the piano, and a table with a record player. Most of the records from which he played selections were old 78s, not new LPs. Music 1 was a gut course, but with an asterisk. The exams had a drop-the-needle section, where short selections would be played, dropping the phonograph arm and its needle at a certain place on a record from works that were on the listening list. The student was supposed to identify the work. There were only a couple of dozen works on the list, and, drawn from 600 years of music, no two pieces on the list were remotely similar. Depending on your auditory memory, Drop the Needle was either completely easy, making the course a gut, or completely impossible, as for any tone-deaf student who made the terrible mistake of taking the course. Like other Harvard gut courses, Music 1 was full of wonderful glib factoids. The third movement of Haydn symphonies always has the rhythm of, "Are you the old lady who runs this hotel?" Brahms loved little melodies that chase their own tail, and he then inevitably later inverts them. Vivaldi never met a circle of fifths that he didn't like. Richard Strauss favors the French horn because his father was a hornist. Mozart plays three-card monte. You think you know which of three repetitions is going to be the different one, but you never get it right. The only great composers in the first half of the 20th century were Stravinsky, Prokofiev, and Bartok. Shostakovich was a hack not worth listening to. Copland was the greatest American composer. It took me years to recognize that Music One's view of the 20th century had a parochial Harvard-centric tinge. Copland and Bartok, who both lived in New York City in the post-war period, had Harvard connections. Leonard Bernstein, Harvard class of 1939, also kept a connection to the Harvard Music Department. The dismissive view of Shostakovich came directly from Bartok, whose dislike of Shostakovich is well known. For example, the third movement of Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, 1944, incorporates his parody of a main theme from the first movement of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 7, but exaggerated and terminated by a jeering Bronx cheer from the brass. Later that spring, I again tried out for the chorus in the Harvard GNS Players production of Iolanthe and was again rejected. The starring role of the Lord Chancellor was played by an undergraduate, John Lithgow, a name that meant nothing at the time. Each semester during reading periods, the 2 weeks between Harvard's end of classes and beginning of final exams, WHRB abandoned its regular programming for so-called orgy period, big blocks of broadcast time devoted to a single composer or artist, broadcast 24 hours a day. I was appointed acting orgy director, acting only because I was thought to be too junior for the regular title. My job was to coerce people to sign up to program and/or announce these shows. It was easier to do the work myself. On one memorable afternoon, I programmed a 4-hour Ives orgy, a 4-hour Mendelssohn orgy, a 3-hour Wanda Landowska, the harpsichordist, orgy, an 8-hour Copland orgy, and a 5-hour Stravinsky orgy. Jazz orgies, I left to people who knew something about the subject. A reporter from Boston Magazine came to the station to interview me as orgy director, resulting in a talk-of-the-town-style piece in their June issue. I came across as an overly precise and pedantic freshman, which was accurate enough. During orgy period, I was on call whenever a member who had signed up turned into a no-show. Over the 2 weeks in May, I controlled and announced something like 60 hours of air, including my own 16 hours of Gilbert and Sullivan, 4 hours on each of 4 days, and an unexpected jazz DJ shift from midnight to 6 a.m. The most fun was controlling for Hillbilly at Harvard, an oddball show that normally ran on Sunday mornings and had been on since the 1950s. Before country music's nationwide revival, this was Boston radio's only country music show. It was put on by a group of station alumni who were by now lawyers and bankers when they were not masquerading as on-the-air hillbillies. During their orgy programs, they invited listeners, especially female, to come on down to the station and join the party. With 30 people crowding into the small studio room, it almost looked like an orgy. Most of the girls seemed to be high school students. By contrast, when I was one-manning an overnight Schoenberg orgy and offered $5, then a lot of money, to the first person to call in, male or female, I didn't care, the phone didn't ring. Margaret and I spent that summer, 1966, together in Berkeley. She enrolled in the summer offering of Honors First Year Calculus. George Kalmus was happy to hire me back into the Burge Powell Bubble Chamber Group. Margaret and I couldn't room together overtly. She found me a summer sublet with a group of older students on Leroy Avenue, north of campus. She shared an apartment with a group of girls on University Avenue, above a flower shop. There was a 2-week period after Margaret's summer term ended and before I had to go back to Harvard when her parents invited me to stay with them as a house guest. I slept in the small bedroom at the back of the house that was normally occupied by Margaret's older brother Eric, whom everyone called Butch. Butch was away somewhere, but had left behind his fat, 10-foot-long snake, a boa constrictor who stared at me implacably through the glass of his large box the whole time I was there. A crisis occurred, sub rosa, when Margaret ran out of the 3-month supply of birth control pills that had been dispensed by the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Berkeley. Some backstory is needed. Margaret's grandmother Sigrid emigrated to the United States from Denmark in 1915 with Margaret's paternal grandfather, Charles Lauritsen. One of Charlie's projects at Caltech in the early 1930s was to build a large X-ray machine for treating cancer patients. Sigrid accordingly enrolled in medical school at USC and became the university's first female MD graduate. She practiced as a cancer radiologist until she retired in the mid-1950s. What Margaret knew in 1966 was that Sigrid was still licensed to write prescriptions. What Margaret also knew was that Sigrid was incapable of calling anyone's bluff. She was in all matters the world's worst poker player, a trait that made her completely manipulable. The transaction went something like this. Margaret: Sigrid, I need you to write me a prescription for birth control pills. Sigrid: No, you don't. You shouldn't be having sex. Margaret: If you don't give me a prescription, I'll go get pregnant. Sigrid, immediately folding: Okay, what should I write? Margaret, triumphant, handed her the empty pill pack. The pharmacist looked at us oddly when we presented the prescription form. Sigrid's printed pad was from the 1940s, and the form gave only a 4-digit phone number, something like Sycamore 7654. Still, he filled it as written.